All right, fantastic. And we are live exactly 1 o'clock here in Belgrade, Mexican Standard Time. Actually, 56 minutes past the hour. Friday, July 21st, 2023. Coming at you from beautiful Belgrade, Serbia, in glorious 32 kbps. Today, we are going to be joined with Matt Arrett. Matt Arrett's going to be joining us an hour from now, so he'll be with us in our second segment. We're just going to do two segments today. Today I had an impromptu, went over to go visit my Kuma, Ana Maria. She had her baby boy, was born a couple months ago, and she just starting to feel like, she can present herself to the world and her little son. So it's been great to meet him. He looks just like mom, I have to say. He looks just like his mom. And but yeah, he's a very, very sweet little man, 2 months old. Whole life is right in front of him. So we have actually surprise news. I had no idea, of course, what was going to happen. But you have probably heard by now that Igor Strelkov, Strelkov's like a call sign or kind of a fake nom de guerre, or a real nom de guerre, I guess, but it's a fake name. You'll know him as Igor Girkin, maybe, as well. And he's been arrested. I have some interesting ideas about that. And I guess we're going to talk about that. So they have the criminal code in the Russian Federation. So again, Strelkov's been arrested. And for those of you, just to kind of be like, who is Strelkov? You may know him from 9 years ago. He was involved in some battles in the first Donbass war 9 years ago. He was, I believe he was at Kramatorsk. He was definitely at Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And he was known for trying to hold on to Slavyansk. It's today still held by the Ukrainians. There was an indigenous uprising. His group of volunteers came to augment the indigenous force. And they were holding out against the I don't know if the what was called at the time in Ukraine, the ATO, the anti-terrorism operation. I don't know if it was declared yet as such, but they were holding off the forces of the AFU, the Armed Forces of Ukraine, for some time. But they were getting orders from the leadership in Donetsk to withdraw, that, you know, we can't hold on to it. And instead of following orders to withdraw, he defied orders and tried to build barricades and basically, you know, barricade themselves in, putting a lot of civilians in peril along the way. But others would say that this was brave, this was glory, this was, you know, had to be done, and he was betrayed by the puppet of the Kremlin government of Donetsk, betrayed by the, you know, corrupt Kremlin or whatever. And so that was a narrative that was fairly strong in people. And it was divisive at the time, although by and large, it was people liked them. And but then what happened after that is he became a giant, what would you call it? Honey trap. And he was, he's a former military intelligence officer. So he understands how these kind of things work. He actually, if I'm not mistaken, was in the Chechen War. And that's where his experience before Kramatorsk and Slavyansk came from. But what's interesting about him, just sort of as a strange personality character, is that he shares with Justin Trudeau, proclivity for dressing up like old-timey World War I soldiers. So he is kind of known, and a lot of pictures of him that still get used as like the standard photo is him in this kind of World War I uniform, which is very strange because it's kind of like using a reenactment uniform in a real war. It was kind of funny. And, but it kind of lent a distinguishing character to it. And he wore it well, kind of a slender build and a sort of an Errol Flynn mustachioed look. And it worked, you know, he looked very much like the role, probably made Trudeau very jealous, you know. Anyway, so, but subsequently he was known for basically, criticizing things, you know, and I call it criticizing gravity is, I think, the closest approximation to reality. Criticizing gravity is fairly useless, but there's never a shortage of idiots who are looking for anything to grab onto that confirms their, you know, worldview. That is, it's essentially, as you will understand, okay, a liberal criticism of power, okay? What's the difference between a liberal criticism of power and a realist one? Well, typically speaking, realists understand that structures work, but they work to serve the interests of the people in charge. Okay. Liberal criticisms of power assume the truth of the lie, which is that of these institutions of power are placing what you think is the most important thing before all other structural stability type considerations. Does that make sense? So liberal criticisms of power are typically that leadership is inept or they're dumb. Things like this. So this is a very interesting thing. And it's appealing to people, especially people with military experience, who didn't maybe get as far as they would have wanted to in the military, or who quit, or who served honorably and did their, you know, whatever they, maybe they advanced, whatever. And the thing is that every organization has problems. And the larger an organization is, well, sure, you pick up some efficiencies here and there's a trade-off and you lose efficiencies over there and bureaucratic, right? And there's careerism and things like that. The problem is that career military people seldom have any experience, I mean, until they leave the military, with anything else. So they're comparing it to an ideal in their minds. They're not comparing it to how other institutions work normally elsewhere. And they all basically function in a way, just as a kind of a rule of thumb, the organizations function in a way that those within the organization, you know, at the ground level are in amazement that anything happens at all. And, you know, it's not a bad criticism. A lot of the important changes that have to happen in an institution, do come from those observations at the ground level. So this is, should not be confused what I'm saying, should not be discounted. But if you don't understand what is actually happening broadly, it became evident. We read an article the other day by Strelkov, where he's imagining an imminent attack on Russia by Turkey, or that it's gonna that it is an inevitability, and he goes back to saying, oh, I've been saying this since 2014 or 15, which, look, by itself, that's fair. But if it has to be the same dynamics, so much has changed in Turkey. And so many pressures on Turkey and the whole dynamic has changed that it is, it's, I mean, I suppose that if, you know, if we fast forward between now and the next 200 years, yeah, maybe, you know, you can say that there's a increased chance of some conflict between Turkey and Russia. But he never really, he explained the how, and basically talking about how the Russian troops would be trapped. The Russian troops in Syria would be trapped. The conflict would take place in the Black Sea. and in the Caucasus and in Syria. There could be a problem with Turkey, don't get me wrong. It's the formulation that he's coming up with goes back to in Armenia, before the Electric Yerevan, before and in the next color revolution, because that one didn't really take hold, but it laid a firmament or a foundation for the rise of Pashinyan, right? So this is a very different dynamic. So you can't just say, many things have changed. And the Russians are not backing the Armenians versus the Azeris. In fact, if you really look at things, it's both Turkey and Russia courting Azerbaijan, and then Russia as a kind of corollary consideration trying to balance some Armenian interest. But it's very strange because at this point in time, and it has been for four years now, that Russia is doing more to defend Armenia than Armenia is doing to defend Armenia. And then, but because Armenia is doing nothing in its own interest, literally, its government is crap, the Russian interest in defending Armenia's interests is only insofar as Armenia should not implode and create such a disbalance in the world, in the region, that's actually destabilizing. But Russia's interest in helping Armenia has been scaled back in proportion. There are red lines, but just in proportion to where Armenia is at, right? So anyway, so Gherkin or Strelkov, whatever. Hey, it requires more. And what do I mean? Well, take, for example, Douglas MacGregor. So he would know and does know militarily about and has some experience, not as rich, not under the same conditions as Strelkov. He also is a doctor, a PhD in international relations, which is the closest analog to geopolitics in most Western universities. And there's a slightly different focus, but it's just, nowadays it's interchangeable. And but Gherkin doesn't have an understanding of why. So the what, like if it were to happen, he's given an explanation of what's going to happen, right? So so we were just talking about him, what is it, yesterday or the day before? Totally interesting. So today he was arrested. And the charges are falling under the statute of the criminal code, Russian Federation 282, that has to do with extremist groups creating, supporting, et cetera. Okay. Now, for a minute, just think about this, okay? Just to contrast, right? Just understand this, okay? So Prigozhin leads a fucking tank march, a tank assault up a highway heading towards Moscow, right? Ayatollah of rock and roller. And nothing happens to him. And then Gherkin, who's done nothing, I mean, he's super annoying as a troll. Gherkin, who's done nothing, was arrested. What I think is probably happening is that they are going to be making arrests of people that have been Gherkin, Strelkov supporters, people that have been, that are in his fan base. Okay. And Gherkin is I believe, a honey trap. Okay. I think ultimately, and I could be wrong, and maybe they'll do something like give him a year of something, or 2 years or 5 years, and then it'll be a suspended sentence on his own recognizance, or he'll be like on a parole. He has to check in. I mean, he's a former GRU agent. So that's basically, he's been on, what's the difference between that and being on parole? You don't think he's being checked up. Or checked in on all the time, right? I mean, so just understand the context here. And he's been allowed, I mean, this is someone that, oh, you know, there could be a security concern of, you know, extremist organization. He's gone to the front and back and forth a few times. And that's not something that you just do, without permission. And yeah, can you kind of sneak in? Yeah, of course you could. But then once you publicize that you're there, as it was publicized, then the military police, if they want to get you, like if he was in Donetsk or Lugansk or wherever he was recently, 6 months ago or a year ago when he arrived on the front this time, he would have been apprehended at the time. I'm not saying he was at large, but he would have been determined to have been at the front without permission. If he didn't have permission, and he would have been apprehended because he's a very public figure. Okay. Are there people that aren't really, you know, figures of any kind that don't have a high profile, that aren't being tracked to begin with, that sneak into the front? And that, well, of course. But this is a very, very high profile. This is like basically he's got a dog tag. You know, he's basically like chipped, right? So, think about that. And, remember that a number of years ago that he was supposed to be involved in this, what was it? March on Moscow against, basically, it wasn't so clear that it was going to be against Putin or against the Kremlin, but kind of obviously it wasn't a march of people that were happy, right, with the way, the slow roll of Russia supporting Donbass, the slow role of Russia developing its position. And, you know, when did Lugansk and Donetsk finally become parts of the Russian Federation? Just last year. So people who had been kind of following him and stuff like this, I would imagine what we're going to see is more arrests. But the other people who are arrested are going to get it for real, because that's what happens with a honey trap. Does that make sense? So in other words, like right now he's been arrested. If he wasn't arrested, and they go and they are going to arrest other people, because it's conspiracy to create a criminal organization or extremist group. So there has to be a group. Maybe you can establish that there's intent. He's an army of one man who's with intent to do it or something like that. But more realistically, there's going to be people who are arrested, or they're probably being arrested now. I'm just late on the news, but it'll happen very soon. If not today, the next day or two. And his cover won't be blown because he was arrested also. And even though they have all the information on these guys that they're going to arrest the whole time, people are going to think that, you know, that they beat the information out of Strelkov, or they might even do something where they beat him and he refused to give the information. There's many different ways you can play that. come back to the homies with a broken nose and a shiner, be like, oh no, man, I'm no rat. Anyway, so very interesting story with Strelkov. Now, I'm very interesting to see what happens with that. There's many people saying, you know, it was about time. You know, there's definitely people that are saying that this is something that was late coming. Yeah, there's people that got very tired of his trolling. They consider it trolling anyway. Again, today in about 45 minutes, we'll be joined, if I'm not mistaken, in other words, I mean, you know, unless he sleeps in or something is what I'm saying, by Matt Arrett. I don't think it'll be 9 a.m. in Montreal at the time that he's supposed to be on. So what is it, about 8:15 in the morning now? So I think we'll be good. I think he'll be He'll be fine. I have faith. I didn't see him in the green room yet. He's not in studio, but we'll definitely, I'll go talk to producer Ann and see if he's, showed up in studio yet. Anyway, so we have, also, a funny, Graham Phillips story. So you guys will know, that Aiden guy. Remember him? Anyway, so this guy's so fucking mentally ill. But I think that Graham Phillips has a better description. So the guy basically, as you know, is a Nazi mercenary. He likes to play dumb. I was just a chef. And he's got kind of a face and a body language that are subversive to your knowledge that he's conniving and stuff like this. Because he's got like a baby face and big puppy dog eyes and a kind of, you know, you might think to feel sorry for the guy is the point there. But what happened, and I think this is kind of, you know, the thing is you would think that he would be just shutting up, that, you know, maybe embarrassed or grateful or whatever. But now he's written a book. Anyway, so what Graham Phillips says is, he says, in fact, I'm going to forward this to the, I'm going to copy, forward this to the comments here. Here we go. This is from, I couldn't send it to the chat directly from Graham Phillips, so I copy pasted it into the chat. He says, I honestly know, this is Graham Phillips, you know, the journalist, and he interviewed, the connection is that Graham Phillips, you know, the English journalist who covers the Donbass very closely, he's often on the ground there, right? Close to the front. A bit of a lad. Yeah, a bit of a lad. Bit of a passport bro in some way. But he does good journalism, right? Hey, it's no one's fault if he gets laid along the way, right? But he says, I honestly never expected to have to speak about Aiden Aslan so much. I viewed him as a career mercenary who'd got extremely lucky, both being taken into captivity and his conditions of captivity. When he was freed after a few months, I had imagined he'd be extremely grateful for his second life and hoped he'd do something worthwhile with it. Instead, Aiden decided to become a social media influencer, troll, and endlessly whine on via multiple different recollections about his detention. That has now resulted in his bringing out his own Prince Harry-style book, even, full of his own victim playing, fabricating, poor me, look at me, fictionalization. Due to Aiden having decided I should play the part of main baddie in his Bookie Wookie, I've been receiving press requests to respond to allegations made against me. This is Graham Phillips. Here, iNews, who in fairness to their journalist, Rob Hastings, have actually presented a reasonable summary of my response. I'd, of course, rather spend my time doing other things, but as I do have to deal with this, we'll deal with it. Okay. So the piece is very interesting. It's on inews.co.uk. It's Aiden Aslan, the British man who fought for Ukraine. War is 80% boredom and 20% totally crazy stuff. 10 months after he's released as a prisoner of war, just a minute. They're trying to throw me under the bus of a paywall here. I'm going to whip out the other browser and try to get behind it. It's like people don't want, it's like you want a subscription and you have ads. So you're blocking people from seeing your ad. You're blocking passive income. it goes, he says, 10 months after release as a prisoner of war, Aiden Aslan, oh, son of a gun. Aiden Aslan reveals his trauma from torture and why he recently went back to Ukraine. Flashbacks to the gunfire, the bombings and the trenches of Ukraine can hit Aiden Aslan at any moment. Oh, he's got PTSD. He's a piece of PTSD. Okay. Can hit him at any moment. 10 months since this young man from Nottinghamshire, Nottinghamshire. I just know that where I come from, we have Wilshire Boulevard, but we know when people aren't from LA, they call it Wilshire. So I don't know. Nottinghamshire was freed as a prisoner of war after volunteering with the Ukrainian Marines in 2018 and being captured by invading Russian forces in April last year. The dark effects of his experience can still cloud his eyes and fill his ears. Sometimes they appear like a projection of an explosion in my peripheral vision, Aslan explains. It's not like a hallucination. I can still see everything, but there's also a second layer. I feel the shockwave and hear the air ringing. He has panic attacks too. They have made him faint in the past, though he's learned to wait for them to pass, trying to distract his mind by taking sips of water. I have to stop what I'm doing, take a few breaths. Oh, poor guy. This has been punishment enough. In fact, Russia should be paying for his shrink, huh? And then there are nightmares. Aslan is glad he hasn't had one in a few weeks, but the most recent one was hard to shake. I was on the front line, but I'd been captured. I remember waking up and looking at the clock on the wall, and I was questioning, is this real? I had to wake up my fiance. Oh, that's where he pretends to be straight. I had to wake up my fiance just to hear her voice, just to get back into reality. He's grateful for treatment he's receiving from a psychologist. I thought that did okay. This is why it's good to not read these first and then just react as you're reading it. And you're already thinking like, oh, God, I bet he's got a shrink and everything, right? PTSD. All right. So, in fact, here he goes. He does have a shrink. Through the charity Hostage International, but realizes it will be a slow process, especially knowing all my friends and the majority of my battalion are still in captivity. Like, he gives a fuck. I've put a lot of weight on. Because of the way I'm dealing with the trauma, I don't even enjoy food. It's self-destructive, just eating with no care. Wow, yeah, it looks like he's ballooned out to about 300 pounds. That's impressive. If you look at him in Kurdistan, so-called, in the Syrian conflict, where he was a terrorist on the wrong side of history, He was chunky there too. In fact, the only time he was slender, was, you know, when they were whatever, eating dead soldiers or whatever in the catacombs at Azovstal, right? When they were resorting to cannibalism. He goes, I put on a lot of weight because the way I'm dealing with trauma, I don't even enjoy food. That's what I told my wife. I didn't even enjoy the sex, honey. I don't even know her name. It's self-destructive, just eating with no care. Sitting with Aslan and hearing his account of what he went through, it's no wonder that he's been suffering psychologically, just like millions of invasion victims. He survived the hellish Russian siege of Mariupol, where he and 500 comrades surrendered to Russian forces. He was tortured. He heard another prisoner having the life beaten out of him. He was filmed in captivity by a British YouTuber, of all people, and says he felt intimidated into giving false confessions and denouncing the cause he believed in. Finally, he was sentenced to death. He knows it could have been worse, though. So much worse, because somehow he's alive. After being released through a prisoner exchange, arranged a little bizarrely by Saudi Arabia and the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, he's recovering with help from his British family and his Ukrainian partner, Diana, plus Jingles, a gray cat he rescued from the front line. He's written a book, Putin's Prisoner, and even traveled back to Ukraine recently to raise donations for two army trucks. Now, what's interesting here is that they show a picture of a man in the article next to a truck, and they're saying that it's him, and it's clearly not him. So we do know that he was there. But this photo that they're saying is him, that is not him. That is definitely not him. Anyway, they're saying returning to a place where missiles can strike anyone at any time might seem like the worst thing to do for a victim with post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, you fucking think. But Aslan says it helped a lot and felt natural to be in the country he now views as home. I wanted to see friends that I was in captivity with who got released and see what was left of our house, he explains. The roof was damaged because a Russian rocket hit in one of the neighboring houses because it was abandoned for a year. The winter weather pretty much destroyed the inside, but I managed to collect like a lot of our stuff, which is still in good nick. Now, what this guy, what they're not talking about here, where his house is. I don't want to say anything factually incorrect, but I remember a story about that, but I don't. Anyway, so he says, it was abandoned for a year. The winter weather pretty much destroyed the inside, but I managed to collect like a lot of our stuff, which is still in good nick, he says. While he was out there, he was confronted by the sad sight of the once vast Kakhovka Reservoir, now drained of water after its dam was destroyed by Russian forces. Well, that's a claim. That's just a claim, right? That it was destroyed by Russian forces. The Russians didn't say they destroyed it. There was no investigation about it, right? It was like a mini ocean because of how big it was, he recalls. Meeting I at his publisher's office in Central, that's the iNews, right? Meeting the interviewer at his publisher's office in Central London, Aslan feels ready to share his stories. He speaks calmly. He smiles often. He has a placid air about him. The phrase happy days is tattooed on his forearm. He doesn't seem like the kind of person you'd imagine flying off to foreign battles. That's because he's a psychopath. His horrific experiences beg the question, no matter how just the cause, what convinced him to leave the market town of Newark-on-Trent to fight for Ukraine? Yeah, that's a good question. Aiden Aslan's journey to Ukraine. When Aiden Aslan walked out of the ruins of the Ilyich Steelworks in Mariupol, that's the Azovstal one, Azovstal Ilyich, right? With his hands up, Russia's so-called special military operation was just a few weeks old. By that time, however, the Midlander had already been a member of the Ukrainian military for 3 years. In fact, this wasn't even his first war. Aslan had, quote, no interest in the military growing up, no interest in the British Army, end quote, he says. Having both dyslexia and dyscalculia, so he can't add or read. He left school with few qualifications and was struggling to find a mission in life until he became consumed by the, quote, university of the internet. He spent hour after hour scurrying down rabbit holes, he writes in his book, reading articles and watching videos about global politics, compelled by stories of injustice. And much like the world in August 2014, he was outraged when reports emerged of ISIS massacring thousands of Kurdish-speaking Yazidi families at Sinjar in northern Iraq. Well, hold on a second. Hold the fuck on a second. This is not a person that have found a mission in life by going down rabbit holes on the internet, because the narrative of ISIS versus Kurds, while both sides were backed by different groups in the U.S., right? You had ISIS being backed by the CIA and the YPG, then SDF being backed by the Pentagon. Remember that? That's not information that you get from digging. The story of bad ISIS attacking innocent Kurds, in fact, they're both bad. But that narrative was the mainstream narrative, that you'd have to be a fucking, have probably be fucking dyslexic and have dyscalculia or whatever and not be able to read or do basic math in order to arrive at such conclusions. So it doesn't even make sense. No one went down any rabbit holes and said, oh, I support the YPG, right? In the West, people that supported YPG were people like Max Blumenthal before he changed his fucking tune, that fucking opportunist, or anarchists, and, you know, and the YPG very cynically had CIA people doing their whole presentation, doing CIA people doing their whole presentation of who they are to the world. So, you know, YPG is, you know, very distantly, like in its, because it came out of the anti, you know, post-colonial movement, it came out of World War II, came out of Middle East politics. They're basically Marxist-Leninist, but they kind of try to brand as libertarian socialists or, you know, worker communists or whatever, or, you know, something like this. And, but they're Kurds. I mean, it's they live in third world conditions. Their concerns and their interests are strictly and purely, mid-century modern, meaning their aims and their platform correspond to where the kind of insurgent third world, anti-colonial or left-wing movements were like in the 1950s and 60s. Think pan-Arabism and things like that, although this is Kurd, so they're not Arabs, but just that's the milieu. That was the motif and the thing of the time. And, but what the way that the CIA helped the YPG brand is being a pro, you know, that they have trannies and gays and lesbians, and they very much focused on projecting that to the West. So that people like, Max the Opportunist Blumenthal, could, you know, with his daddy, the Clinton appointee, right? Could capitalize, and people presented that to the world like the feminist trans, trans inclusive radical feminists of the YPG with their, you know, anarcho commune, versus, you know, Assad, the dictator, right? The fascist dictator Assad. That was the whole narrative, by the way, right? So for for people like this guy, who very much were drawn into things that were based on the idiot narrative. So this is an idiot who follows the idiot narrative. Okay. Also, by the way, dyslexia and dyscalculia are real things. They are real things. But it's hard to separate the type of personality that a person develops as a consequence of that versus an asshole that you can't get to focus and concentrate because they're fucking assholes. Very hard to distinguish between the two. It's very hard to distinguish between the two. You know, what caused what? If you listen to his mom, if you talk to Aiden Aslan's mom, you would know that he's a compulsive liar, piece of shit that even his own mother doesn't trust. However, she could have been the abusive force that never trusted him, et cetera, that pushed him to being into the asshole that he is. So who knows, right? Who knows? But as far as the world is concerned, we're not his crisis intervention counselors. This is a terrorist who joined Nazis to indiscriminately kill. And I believe that he is an occupier, that his home is a home that he's been squatting in, his Ukrainian house he'd been squatting. In other words, it's in one of the places that had a high Russian population that's been ethnically cleansed. And Azov and groups like this, basically, and Pravi sector and stuff like this in eastern Ukraine, if it's in the zone of the ATO, Ukrainian authorities look the other way when individual soldiers, it's called quartering, actually, but it's quartering with an eviction of the original owners. So just commandeering a house, it's quartering. It's one of the things that caused the American Revolution. So when he's talking about, oh, my house. Well, yeah, after you took it from a Russian. Anyway, so This is the background. So he goes, he spent an hour after hour scurrying down rabbit holes. Okay, I don't believe that. He goes, a handful of young British Muslims became radicalized through social media and flew out to join the jihadist militants in Syria. Aslan was also sucked into the conflict by the online world, only in the opposite direction. Well, no, it was the same type of people, working for the same type of people. Like, you understand that the YPG and ISIS simulating a fight against each other was the pretext for the U.S. to go in to Syria. Even though there was like this other thing about Assad versus the FSA, right? There was also YPG versus ISIS. And the U.S. was using the pretext of this simulated fight between the YPG and ISIS. At times they did fight. We also have helicopter footage of them trading equipment and trading assets. Especially since he became the SDF, which includes parts of the former FSA, of the FSA, of the non-Turkish FSA. So now you have a bifurcation of FSA, TFSA, and you have those former FSA that were anti-TFSA that integrated into the SDF, former YPG. You guys know the story. A handful of young British Muslims became radicalized through social media, blah, blah, blah. But he went the other way. After learning about Western volunteers traveling the Middle East to help the Kurds, he decided to do the same. He researched how via a Facebook group. Oh, isn't that nice? Because I know all the Facebook groups of people that are doing anything decent in the world get instantly fucking shut down. And he wouldn't have made it anywhere. He would have had the MI5 or the British police at his door and arrested him. Right? This is the country, right, at that you post things on Facebook, right? The UK, you post things on Facebook that the authorities don't like, and they come knocking on your door to ask you about what you posted or confirm that it was you. But this guy somehow thinks that he's gone down rabbit holes and he's counter-narrative. You see what a fucking asshole you're dealing with here? Just keep this in mind. So he goes, after learning about blah, 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 he went there via, he researched how to get there from Facebook. I said to myself, I can either sit here and continue complaining. You mean eating, dude? While no one is doing anything, or I can go over there and try to help, he says. It's very easy for someone to go on the internet and find a conflict to fight in. Literally, all you need to do is buy a plane ticket to that country. And once you get there, you can find your connections. Not really, dude. It pretty much, what he doesn't understand is that all these conflicts that he's interested in are ones that are supported by his own fucked up government. What a fucking mongoloid. You know what? You encounter a lot of this stuff as well on the left. I know it's kind of weird, but he's actually, it won't make sense because he's like a liberal kind of leftish guy, actually. But this is the whole liberal Nazi thing. You have to kind of know what's happening at this level with kids on the internet and stuff to understand. But broadly, just get that everything he's interested in are things that actually that the British are backing. So he goes, literally all I have to do is go buy a plane ticket to the country. And once you're there, you can find your connections. Yeah, they didn't arrest you when you came back, though, dude. That tells you all you need to know. They didn't put out, you didn't end up on a terrorist watch group in the UK. Also tells you all you need to know. He's correct, no doubt about that, but the casual nature of his words is still alarming. Aslan believes he didn't kill anyone during his two spells with the Kurdish YPG group in Syria, though he nearly died himself. Okay, just think about this mindset. Okay, so this is someone else's conflict. No one asked or invited him. He asserted and imposed himself over there, then insists that despite being armed and there to kill people, that he didn't kill anyone, but he was almost the victim in a situation that he got on the airplane to go put himself in. One of his colleagues radioed for a U.S. airstrike on an ISIS unit, but mistakenly gave their own coordinates instead of the enemy's. Uh, Well, you know, the thing is that the ISIS guys were also calling into the U.S. for airstrikes on YPG guys. So who knows what actually happened? Because the U.S., different factions, sure, but the U.S. was backing both sides in that conflict. I mean, both sides of the fake, they weren't backing Assad. The whole thing was a pretext for Assad must go. Anyway, it goes on. One of his colleagues radio, yeah, they're right. So in the radio, it's like, did he want to go visit that colleague? Radioed in for an airstrike on an ISIS unit, but mistakenly gave their own coordinates instead of the enemy's. Several people died and others were left screaming with horrible injuries. So they got fucking struck by the, oh God. He traveled back home and was questioned extensively by a special branch. But it was his first bout of post-traumatic stress disorder that was more troubling. Reliving the bombing in his mind, the panic attacks were so bad, he suffered blackouts. Poor guy. Is there a way we can send him money? Wow. In light of this, that same question seems even more pertinent. How did he still have an appetite for war? And why Ukraine? Partly it was because he longed for the military lifestyle. I miss the structure, and when you're in a group, the only thing you worry about is yourself and your friends, he says. After Syria, I was looking for other avenues, like maybe the French Foreign Legion. He began reading more about Ukraine's continuing struggle against Russia, which 4 years earlier had annexed Crimea and provided military support to separatists who set up pro-Kremlin states in the Donbas region. Obviously, what you can see is that this is someone that wants to go on safaris that are approved by his government. That's the only thing consistent in the narrative so far. He's looking for conflict. He's looking for trouble. So you understood that. He wanted to go fight in something after Syria. You heard that. He said that himself. So then he began looking for a cause, right? Why didn't he land on the Russian cause? How did he land on the Ukrainian cause? Because the same fucking mercenaries, it's not like happening in a vacuum, that fought for YPG are also people that often come out of the French Foreign Legion, or there's a Spanish equivalent as well. I happen to know a few people who interestingly actually fought on the Russian side. People are not happy afterwards when a few of those guys then went to go fight on the YPG side in Syria. And the background of that is that there are coordinators. These aren't individuals just randomly getting into this. A lot of the people that recruit in this do have their fingers in this, how would you say, these different wars that the people from the French Foreign Legion invariably, well, we've seen, for example, in Mariupol, remember we saw at Azovstal, we saw when Russians, or was it Chechens, dug out French Foreign Legion berets. Remember that? Remember the French Foreign Legion berets? Someone tried to cast aspersions on it, said, oh no, that tag on the inside is one that wouldn't appear. Da, da, da. I asked my buddy, I said, is that right? He goes, no. He's like, some people have that thing. There's several different manufacturers that people in French Foreign Legion get their berets from. So it was okay. There's a quote here. I became desensitized to violence. That's not what they said during interrogation, dude. You said you were crying for your fuck. Oh, you're desensitized to other people dying. That's because you're always desensitized to other people dying. That's why you are a safari dude. Fucking asshole. He began reading about Ukraine's continuing struggle against Russia, which forged blah, blah, blah. Not many people realize there was still fighting going on in Ukraine. Before the full-scale invasion, it was often categorized as Europe's forgotten war.
No, it wasn't, by the way. Anyway, says Aslan. Wanting to start a new life, he also learned that he could attain citizenship from the Kiev government if he joined their armed forces. The process took months. Oh, months. Wow. Wouldn't you expect years? Okay. But by the end of 2018, he was a member of the Ukrainian Marines on a 3-year contract. The following year, he was on the front lines with comrades who called him Johnny, as they couldn't pronounce his name. They couldn't say Aiden. In a trench, it can be very mentally demanding because of the conditions you're living in. In summertime, it's not too bad. But when it gets to winter, you're looking at temperatures of, at worst, minus 20, he says. War is probably 80% boredom and 20% totally crazy stuff. You're mostly digging, improving your position, building stuff, or doing what you can to pass the time, like cleaning your kit or hygiene. Then you have that 20% where something does happen and you go to shoot and you go shoot. The fighting rarely led to any military achievements by either side, he says. Quote, you shoot at each other until one side gets tired and then you go back to what you're doing, end quote. During his time away from the front line, he met Diana on a dating app. Have you seen his chick? I'm sorry, that shit matters. It does matter. Have you seen his chick? Catastrophic. Like purple green hair thing going on. Just total, like she's like, looks like a, I don't know. It's very strange too, because this is a part of the world with some very, very nice genetics. I guess he felt like he wanted to be in control of the situation. I don't know. Diana on a dating, that's a pretty name, not a pretty girl. She was teaching English in Lviv. They moved in together in Mykolaiv. Yes. So Mykolaiv is in Mykolaiv region, and it's not a place in the ATO. So that's a correction. And Aslan readied himself to leave the army, contemplating becoming a war reporter instead. Oh, he thought about it. In 2021, he was convinced to renew his contract for one more year, but that would be it. By December, fears of a Russian invasion were increasing. And that month, in the depths of winter, he killed another human for the first time. He was firing mortar bombs at the Russian positions, and the next morning, his unit received intelligence that they had killed an enemy soldier. Aslan admits to feeling strangely numb about the news. Oh, fucking shut up. It's like even hearing that you did something and then somebody died because of it, you know, you'd have to believe that he wasn't prepared, that he's not in a culture, in the local. I mean, none of that makes sense, but whatever. They're trying to paint him as some kind of armed pacifist, right? He's a safari pacifist. Think about that. Try to wrap your head around that. He was firing mortar bombs, and they told him, Aslan admits to feeling strangely numb about the news. Because of the environment I was in, I became desensitized to violence. Well, no, you didn't become desensitized to violence. You became desensitized to other people's, to violence upon other people. He begged for his life. I mean, if you're desensitized to violence, that's like you're not worried about your own life even. Being desensitized to other people's violence just is what makes you a sociopath. Just so you understand, okay? But if you're still concerned about your own life or the life of people you care about, you're not desensitized to violence. You're just a psychopath or sociopath. You understand the difference? It's acquired. It's not, you don't have to be born that way either. It can be social environment, et cetera. There's a lot of literature on it. it goes, so he finds out about this. So capture and torture. There's no evidence he was tortured. You saw him doing when he was captured. They absolutely did not torture this guy, right? Why? Because it was such a, they allowed him to post on YouTube while he was in captivity. Remember, they allowed him to make a YouTube channel and everything like that. Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Is that a full-scale invasion? Not really, huh? Anyway, was predicted for weeks, and Aslan still found it hard to absorb the reality when the onslaught began. Instructing Diana to seek refuge in the UK, he and his unit were swiftly pushed back to Mariupol, the Marines found themselves in the Ilyich Steelworks just north of the Azovstal plant, which became, well, it's in the entire plant facility, right? Which became infamous for the suffering its defenders went through. Infamous for the suffering of the people there. Oh, the soldiers. Its defenders went through. The suffering soldiers. From here, they had a great vantage over the land and could see where Russian troops had fired a rocket from the countryside towards the city. I could go into cover, quote, I'd go into cover and come back out. I heard it pass. I'd see where it landed, and it would always be in the residential area behind us, watching blocks of flats exploding, he writes in his book. He felt sure he was witnessing war crimes. So this is actually something that's actually been discussed at length, and the forensics and the people. And remember that girl. Here's the thing. Remember that Ukrainian social media influencer that was pregnant and she was going to be giving birth there, and then the conflict started. Remember that whole thing? And the media tried to paint it like, well, they said that she had died, but then they used different photos of her to claim that she was different people, the same person, etc. And she was very clear that the Russians were not shelling Mariupol. In fact, Russians took very high losses not shelling Mariupol. They used Chechens, incidentally. They lost a lot of tanks. They were using an older method of where the tank is in the vanguard instead of basically being... they were using the German style of tanks, of using tanks from original, like, 100-year-old tank doctrine, as opposed to the British, the old original British concept of using a tank is actually more like mobile artillery, like wheeled artillery that's armored, not as something that you have in the vanguard as part of a, as let's say, like a fighting group, or like as a, to be, you know, reinforced by, you know, advancing troops in the front, right? So, they, Russians did lose a lot of tanks in Mariupol, but what you see, the damage in the buildings is from tanks. And it wasn't, he's saying that they were doing indiscriminate shelling, and in fact, the Russians did not shell Mariupol. The damage that you see in Mariupol is from RPG, mortar, and tanks. And these were in proximity in fighting block by block. Yeah. So that was one of the things about Mariupol. This was like one of the first major sieges and battles, you know, in the conflict. And tactics and things have changed since then, but including the girl that was at the hospital, remember that kind of the heavy set blonde girl with the green eyes, kind of looked like Miss Piggy from the Muppets. Remember that one who did the, who Ukrainian media tried to say certain things, and then later she came out. She got away over to the Russian side ultimately, because I guess she was actually secretly a Russian sympathizer. And after that media thing, she clarifies, she goes, no, the Russians were not shelling. That the damage that you see in the buildings is from what? From tanks, from gunfire, things like this. Also from the Ukrainian, anti-defenses. Anyway, so. He goes, there was no way out. He would pass time by watching films like Inglourious Basterds and Dunkirk repeatedly on Netflix, as well as episodes of Rick and Morty. Okay. Idiot confirmed, but things became desperate. There was a lot of shelling and fighting going on around the outskirts of the city. Isn't it weird that he was watching Inglourious Basterds, but he was actually fighting on the side of the Nazis? Isn't Inglourious Basterds about killing Nazis? Kind of on the wrong side, huh? Weird, huh? But he's not a thinking person, as you understand. I mean, he thinks in terms of self-survival. Like he's, you know, he can lie on his feet. You know what I mean? Like he can tell he can spin a tale on his feet pretty quickly and divert, confuse what his intentions are, what he's doing. Totally weird dude. I personally think he should have been executed. I believe. And I don't think that I'm not in favor of the of corporal punishment in civilians in a society for crimes. Maybe like a mass murderer, but a person in prison for murder, you know, like one life in prison is a much better way to reflect on what you've done for the rest of your life. And it leaves open the possibility for appeals. People sometimes get wrongly convicted. And it's a much larger miscarriage of justice to put an innocent person to death. You see what I mean? So anyway, but this is a military thing. And I think he should have been executed. And I think that, I hope that Russia learned its lesson. It's very interesting that we were just talking earlier today about exactly what happened with the emboldened Azov. Remember, I wrote a little letter or essay earlier today, this morning. So it goes, eventually, there was a lot of shelling and fighting going on the outskirts of the city. By the final few weeks, supplies were running low. At one point, I went to where the cooks were preparing our food with these huge steel cooking drums. It was probably 2 days old, but I was scraping off the burnt parts of the drum just to eat something. I knew I needed the energy because at that point, pretty much everyone knew that sooner or later, we were going to have to break out or surrender or eat each other. Eventually, he had no choice. He was among a lorry load of Ukrainian soldiers who drove out of Ilyich to hand themselves in. Remember that? They broke discipline. So he wasn't one of the guys that came out of Azovstal after the long siege. Remember all that? No, he was someone that, isn't that weird? Remember that story about that small unit that left and snuck out in the night to go surrender to the Russians? He was with them. So he left his comrades behind, just so you understand. All this talk about went to back to Ukraine to see my comrades and stuff. No. In fact, you left. You broke discipline. You broke the orders. And tried to get out and save your own skin and left your comrades there to fight or die. That's actually what happened. So it says, eventually they had no choice. Well, they did have a choice because the other guys stayed there, didn't they? So he had no choice. You always have a choice. You always have a choice. Some choices are more difficult than others, but you always have a choice. He goes, the Russian soldiers were not abusive. Quote, I'll give them credit. They treated us pretty normal, but the captives were handed to the pro-Russian quislings running the so-called Donetsk People's Republic in occupied eastern Ukraine. That's when the aggression started. When a guard asked his nationality and Aslan said the UK, he thumped me on the nose and beat me a few times. At first, he says he wasn't scared. It's the reality of war. You're going to get beat. But the next day, he was separated from the Ukrainian-born men, and he was subjected to full-on torture. A guard who may have been drunk continually beat me with a truncheon. I was in agony. Well, I hope that's what happened, but I doubt it. And after, he believes, was what an hour and a half, he was stabbed in the back of his shoulder with a penknife. That I can almost guarantee happened from another inmate. I can almost guarantee that comes from another inmate. Being stabbed in the shoulder. When you were in the shower, what happened? Fellatio gone wrong? What happened? Dropped your soap? That's when I went into survival mode, he says. Submission is probably the best way to describe it. By this point, I'd already been knocked unconscious. I remember telling myself, if I take another beating, if I continue, I don't think I'm going to wake up. I could feel myself slowly losing that grasp of reality. Right, fucker, because you've had such a very firm grasp on reality this whole time. Other British men captured in the war have also alleged they were tortured by pro-Russian forces. Andrew Hill, another military volunteer, claims he was beaten. John Harding, who was teaching Ukrainian soldiers how to use first aid kits, that sounds innocent, right? Says he was used as a punching bag in Donetsk. Aid worker Dylan Healy, first aid just to understand when they talk about first aid and things like this, and okay, in what you would call a platoon, you've got a guy that knows all the standard procedures of field triage, okay? But they carry a gun. Now, they use that they have triage training to their advantage. It's a trade-off. In other words, you have a field commander or a unit commander or a platoon commander, and at the platoon, I'm calling it platoon, at the level of the smallest fighting unit, if you've got someone like this, good, right? You don't want that person to be in the most, vulnerable fighting positions. You want to keep them back a bit, because you need them when other guys take flak or whatever. You see what I mean? When other guys take a bullet, take shrapnel, flak, whatever, you need them. So a lot of these foreign mercenaries, because they do have experience in the military, will apply on the basis of field medic certification so that they can make sure that things stay like a safari. Like, okay, you guys go in, I'll stay back here with the commander, but we're gonna provide cover. We'll keep shooting, we'll provide cover. You guys go in, operation, get behind the guys without field medical training, right? Submission is probably the best way to describe it. Dude, I think submission is your thing anyway. He looks like he totally comes off like a sub. Other British men captured in the war have alleged they were tortured. We read that. Aid worker Dylan Healy, that's where we were at, right? It was a few days later that Aslan found himself in a room with Graham Phillips, a former UK civil servant. Phillips is another Nottinghamshire expat in Ukraine. But that's where the two men's similarities end. Oh, they're both from the same place. I didn't know they were from the same town or shire. Phillips has attracted hundreds of thousands of followers online while making films about the conflict in Ukraine. An independent journalist, he described himself, or an ex-sex blogger turned pro-Kremlin YouTuber, in the words of critics. Look, see, I wasn't casting aspersions when I said Graham Phillips was a bit of a lad, a bit of a passport bro. He describes himself as an ex-sex blogger. All right, so this is not an accusation. This is Graham Phillips, okay? Phillips filmed a 44-minute video with Aslan interview, hovering over his interviewee, who sat in handcuffs, looking forlorn. The video's release provoked a storm of condemnation. The then Prime Minister Boris Johnson accused Phillips of making propaganda messages for Putin. Minister of Parliament Robert Jenrick said he was, quote, in danger of prosecution for war crimes, end quote. And the barrister Jeffrey Robertson Casey said the film appeared to be, quote, coercive interrogation. The Geneva Convention states that POWs must always be protected from intimidation and becoming objects of public curiosity. That has long been interpreted as an international ban on POWs ever being filmed in captivity, where fear of torture or execution means they can feel compelled to offer false admissions of guilt or make statements against their own side to be used as propaganda by their captors. Very well, but hold on a second. So he's apprehended, or he surrendered. They snuck out, remember, of Azovstal, while the other guys were, I guess, starting to resort to cannibalism or whatever. He's apparently British, okay? And you would just be, so he's being processed. How much active cooperation is there from the, you know, communication with the Ukrainian authorities about the exact legal status of every person fighting? You've got mercenaries, you've got international brigade. Okay. None of those people are afforded the status of POW in a conflict. None of those people have any rights of a soldier. They're dead to rights. Anyone from international brigade, any mercenary, can be summarily executed on the spot. Now, in his case, it may be that that he was, and as he says, an actual normalized, you know, member of the Ukrainian Marines, not as a foreigner, you see, and would be afforded those rights. But if you've watched the interview, the only one that I thought was a little distasteful was the one that, that Mark, the former Florida sheriff guy, Dugan, not to be confused with the philosopher, different spelling, no relation. That Mark, the Florida cop, Florida man, I thought that his interview with Aslan, making him sing the Russian anthem and stuff, was, you know, hazing, but it's not like worse than what, I mean, it's far less bad than what, you know, white dudes do to each other in college to join a fraternity, right? Like when you take a pledge or something. I've seen it in movies. I don't know anything about the Greek system. Not my cup of tea. So it says, Geneva Convention states POWs must always be protected from intimidation, become objects of public curiosity, et cetera, et cetera. This, Aslan claims, was exactly what happened during his questioning by Phillips. In the video, he nods along with everything that Phillips says, agreeing that he has requested the interview. Now, I would agree, just in general, and you guys know on this channel, that at the start of this conflict, from the very beginning, I said, I don't want to show videos of Ukrainian troops talking about how much they hate that they had to be Ukrainian troops, because once you're captured, and the thing is that people don't even have to feel that they're under pressure to say that. I mean, the fact of being captured changes your, like, many people are not strong-willed, or they don't know what the relationship between their beliefs and their present situation is. People are amazingly obtuse and fail in the arena of introspection. So I know that many soldiers, once captured, do regret it. But they don't necessarily regret it before that. And on the other hand, as the war has progressed, okay, as I have seen more and more people being taken in as POWs, who are obviously in their 60s, who obviously have health problems, who obviously are grandfathers, and they're saying things about their commander abandoned them and things like that, this conforms to other things that we have learned about this conflict. I don't know that each testimony is true, but the concept is credible now. So on those videos in the past year or so, I have been sharing those when they're talking about certain issues. But there's a lot of them I don't share because it's just, you know. So I would actually agree with some of this concept going on here about the kind of lack of authenticity of, you know, basically interviews conducted under some degree of duress. I mean, in terms of what Aidan Aslan believed he was getting out of it, is it was bringing public attention to it. And it was known that people were going to see this on YouTube and stuff like that, or wherever that, you know, Graham Phillips, you know, and that, and so it was good for him to do. But the whole story is totally ridiculous. I mean, it's beyond hilarious. So he has this book we're talking about is come out called Putin's Prisoner. And it's talking about Graham Phillips, because Graham Phillips is like the main bad guy in the book. So Graham Phillips suggested that we read this article, which he says is fairly fair, actually. And so he goes, this whole time, the man who stabbed him was standing a few feet away, he writes in Putin's Prisoner,
This interview was psychological torture. I still have trouble, flashbacks dealing with this, how Graham Phillips took apart my integrity long after my physical wounds had healed. Jesus Christ, man. Like, guys, literally a safari, bro. Literally went to go kill human beings. Pretends only after he killed his first human that he became desensitized to war. That he became desensitized to violence. Well, how come you're not fucking desensitized to being stabbed in the back, bitch? How come you're not fucking desensitized to threats or intimidation or hazing? Because you're not desensitized to violence. You're desensitized to the violence that you've inflicted on other people. You're not desensitized to violence. Jesus, man. It's like, am I tripping here? Are we hearing the same fucking story? YouTube removed the video, but Phillips is still releasing it on others on the platform. Aslan tells me, under the circumstances of what he did and what he's continuing to do, there should be a total ban of his YouTube channel. Right. So he should be free to travel back to Ukraine to kill people, but Phillips can't talk about the man who goes and kills people. All right. There has been zero contact from the ICC stating, well, the UK is not a member, is not a signatory to the ICC. Convenient, of course, you know, for England, for the UK. Anyway, he goes, I was asked by Aden Aslan to do an interview with him. This is what Philip says. I conducted an interview professionally. Aden Aslan asked him. I conducted the interview professionally with integrity, decency, and the full adherence to the applicable protocols, including Geneva Convention, Phillips writes. I treated Aden humanely and with dignity, something he himself acknowledged at the time. I saw the interview. It was he was very friendly and very warm and did not treat Aden like the piece of shit that he is. He treated him, you guys have probably seen the interview. So it's totally at odds with, oh, the man who stabbed me in the back was there in the room and that's why I had to. No, it was, he requested him. That much is known. This is very funny. Philip writes, he even defends the guard who allegedly beat and stabbed Aslan, but admits that, quote, captivity is obviously an extreme situation in which unpleasant things take place. Well, for sure. Maintaining that Aslan was nothing but a mercenary in his view, he argues that his interviewee has, quote, every reason to feel blessed after being freed and accuses him of endless whining and malicious misrepresentation while giving, quote, multiple different versions of events. Last July, Phillips became the first British person to be sanctioned by the UK government for producing, quote, media content that supports and promotes actions and policies which destabilize Ukraine and undermine or threaten the territorial integrity, sovereignty, or independence of Ukraine. How is that a crime? Why is that a problem in the UK? That's so very strange. This is very dangerous stuff. This is the real social credit issue. Going after journalists, right? That's very, very dangerous with this stuff. Phillips claims this move was illegal and intends to fight his case at the High Court later this year. I hope he wins. But Aslan hopes to see him in another court one day, charged with war crimes. I hope to meet Phillips again at The Hague with me in the witness box. And, oh, you fucking drama faggot. Jesus Christ. It's like, we're not going to go through this again. To me, Graham Phillips is evil. Anyway, so he's got his book, Putin's Prisoner, My Time as a Prisoner of War in Ukraine. It was actually written by John Sweeney, the best-selling author of Killer in the Kremlin. So it was ghostwritten, but then it's a publicly ghostwritten thing. As you know, Aslan has crippling ADHD. If you've heard him speak elsewhere, he says he has crippling ADHD. I think that's actually more connected to his inability to read than classic dyslexia, right? This is a stubbornly, a stubbornly distracted person, if that makes sense. I know it's a hard thing to wrap your head around if you haven't encountered it. Anyway, we're a little bit late in today's show. We are going to be speaking with Matt Arrett in just a second. In fact, if Matt is with us, I don't know if Matt can hear me. I see him in the studio now. Talked to producer Ann earlier. She says, yeah, he's in the green room. He was eating the caviar, getting into the cookies. Matt, are you there?
Yeah. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How are you doing?
Good morning over there in Montreal.
Good morning. I just crawled up. I'm a late, the muse, the creative muse tends to hit me usually around 1 a.m. or so. So I tend to go to bed late at night and I just crawled out of bed, but I'm very, very happy to join you, as always. So this is going to be, I hope it's going to be interesting for those listening.
Oh, definitely will. Are you using the phone app or the desktop app?
Desktop app. Should I be using my phone app?
Well, if you've got headphones on, it should work all right.
Like right now, it's not coming through clearly?
It is coming through clearly, actually. Yeah, I was just making sure that I was just trying to be preventative. I did hear there was a little bit of a little echo or whatever, but I think we're good, man. So thanks for jumping out of bed in the very early hour of 9 a.m. But I'm glad, I'm glad that you're with us reporting for duty. You have a new documentary out, a short film about China.
Yes.
I've been sharing it. I've been promoting it on the channel. We're going to do it again after we say goodbye. Tell us what was the question for folks who haven't watched it yet so we can get them interested in it. What was the main question that you wanted to explore that you were curious about? And then when you found out, you wanted to share with people and you got behind produce this documentary.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the topic of the documentary was originally intended to be one thing. It turned out to be something totally different than anticipated. It's actually episode three of an ongoing series.
Right.
A few months ago, my wife and I, Cynthia Chung and myself, we published a special report to sort of help people focus amidst the noise and the misinformation being spread, confusing the zeitgeist, even not just in the mainstream media consumer base, but even something that is increasingly really confused the alternative media consumer base. Of people trying to make sense of the world. And a lot of the people who follow our writings tend to be obviously MAGA-oriented, or at least conservative-minded anti-Great Reset, obviously. But there's been a lot of fear porn and relatively sophisticated, sometimes not sophisticated at all, but there's been a lot of amplification of messaging and narrative reframing, neurolinguistic programming to sort of get everybody to hate and fear China and label China as the cause of all of our problems. So the special report on the Breaking Free of Anti-China PSYOPs produced, I mean, we tried to tackle some of the core tropes. We've got a volume two actually coming out next week on Breaking Free of Anti-China PSYOPs, you know, Uyghur concentration camps. Is it true or is it false? What about Falun Gong, you know, organ eating, CPC militarists, is that true? I mean, we're being told it's true. Is it true? Is there evidence for any of these things? Police stations. That was actually the first video that we turned from our book, so that we adapted content from the special report into video content. We did a 9-minute video on this, on the claims of Chinese police stations internationally, where we were just able to debunk that, get across that. Now this is entirely made up. There's no evidence of any of this ever, but we're, you know, and it's easy to prove. The second one was another 9-minute video, just sort of dismantling the Russiagate material and really just bringing the role of British intelligence, specifically MI6, Richard Dearlove, the same guy that brought us the dodgy dossier that justified the war in Iraq, that sort [S2] Right. [S1] Of brought that back in focus. Obviously, Robert Mueller himself, who carried out the witch hunt, was the director of the FBI while 9/11 was happening. He's the guy who integrated the FBI ever more deeply with MI5 when the MI5 director was brought in the wake of 9/11. Mm-hmm. Complete overhaul of the FBI's methodologies around MI5 methods. So, I mean, Mueller, Richard Dearlove, who was the boss and probably still is the boss of Christopher Steele. Christopher Steele having been the guy that brought us the Dodgy Dossier in the first place, or Dodgy Dossier number two. So all of these figures are often left out of the discussion in a lot of the American media channels that talk about this, whether Gateway Pundit or Epoch Times or anything. They tend to focus on more of like some collusion with the FBI and the Democratic Party, and Hillary is sort of like, you know, seen as the great supervillain along with Soros, and the entire higher operating system of British intelligence, the Rhodes Scholar Network that's penetrated the United States for a century to reconquer the U.S., all of this is left out of the narrative, even the acceptable narratives for the conservatives. So we tried to really just bring that into focus. And then for the current documentary, it turned out to be a lot more than we thought it was going to be, a little, like another easy little 9-minute piece, a little 9-minute video, kind of fun to listen to.
Like 27 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, it grew and grew and grew. And we had to do a few rewrites. We've been working with a very talented filmmaker in Ottawa that I met during the Freedom Convoy. He actually has his own podcast named Jason Dahl. And this guy's just, I had been looking for somebody with this type of multimedia talent for a long time. And I was beginning to despair because I've always wanted to make documentaries. And even when I was in school and university 20 years ago, I was in film animation. My focus was trying to figure out how to make documentaries. I ended up getting sidelined and getting pulled into more of a political, path, but it's always been in the back of my mind. But I could never find anybody with the talent until I met this guy, Jason Dahl. So it's given us the ability to turn a lot of our written content into something fun, especially for the younger audience who needs to sort of learn how to read again. And video is a nice gateway.
But yeah, in the meantime, we can make movies. Yeah. Let me ask you, and also let me kind of, so the audience understands what your relationship to China is. You're not a communist, as I understand. Nope. You're not suggesting that the American system become a communist one.
No.
You're not suggesting that, you're not trying to say that China should control the U.S. or Canada, and that things would be better if China did that, right?
No.
Okay, yeah. Because sometimes people go, "Oh, so you're trying to dispel falsities or rumors or conspiracy theories about China, but you're not actually an advocate of some kind of totalitarian or communist system yourself."
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Which is usually, that's the way the game is.
Know, some people are very black and white thinking, you know what I mean? They have a hard time wrapping their head around that. So, and so tell me about and I know it's not the subject of this latest piece, but tell me about the Chinese police station story. Cause I did hear about too, that China has a network of police stations around the world.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, when you look at like everything, you're like, okay, well, what is the evidence? Where is the evidence? Well, you know, I mean, you hear people repeating it in various media outlets, but where is the evidence before I give my conviction to something? And in this particular case, the evidence of the claim all originates from one organization, which is known as Safeguard Defenders. It's a think tank that was that's set up currently in Spain. Spain specifically is one of the few nations of Europe that you don't have to show as a nonprofit who you're getting your funding from. So that's convenient for them. It's run by this guy, Peter Dahlin, a British fellow, who was expelled from China. He formerly had another outfit that operated until 2016 when he was labeled an enemy agent, receiving foreign funding from specifically CIA front groups by the Chinese government. He was kicked out of China. The organization is escaping. It was I think called China Action. That was actually it. It was called China Action, run by this British guy and some Swiss fellow. And so, they were just like, using information, collecting information, probably managing little networks of operatives on the ground in China, helping to form people in the legalese world to try to, you know, promote democratic rights activists as part of the typical model for color revolutionary activities in every country. You know, use the veneer of human rights, pure democracy, blah blah blah, And then you weaponize these useful idiots to become agents, even if they don't even know it, to destabilize governments that you don't like. And you could easily label authoritarian, in order to sort of like rally the rules-based international order community to support some overthrow of a government. So this guy was kicked out of China. He reset up shop, and he describes how he gave an interview where he said everything I was doing with China Action has taken up, the mission under Safeguard Defenders. And they produced this report, and people could read this thing called, I think it's like 110 Overseas. And I read it. It was like, you know, a 38-page report. And like usual, when you actually read the report, and again, it's funded by, you know, some of the funding came from the European Union, an NED front group, something else. No evidence. A lot of just hearsay, you know, this anonymous person said this. Not actually true. The only thing that is true is that under the whole COVID, craziness, a lot of Chinese people were stuck overseas in Canada and the US, and they couldn't go back home for an extended period. So they couldn't renew basic things like driver's licenses, passport renewal, other things. Like there's all sorts of like logistical nightmares that occurred. So the different consulates, opened up like new offices are providing services for these people to come in, sometimes involving cooperating with a community center that would then, you know, help with a lot of the paperwork and stuff like that. That's like what they relabeled as the police stations.
That is so benign or innocuous or whatever. It's strange to call that a police station.
I know it's literally make believe stuff, but then by repetition and then just citing this report, everything goes back to this Safeguard Defenders grouping and their bullshit reports. Everyone then just ends up nodding their neck, not doing the rigorous research like is usually the case with this stuff. And then ends up just repeating it, as gossip that becomes fact. So yeah, there's a 9-minute video, which maybe I'll email it to you if you want to get that out to the people listening today. And you know, it's a good setup for the episode 3, the big 27-minute video that we're going to talk about a little bit more thoroughly today.
Yes.
And that video originally we wanted it to tackle the claims of China election interference into Canada, which since February of this year have really been like taking up so much of the news cycle. And driving, you know, conservatives, people on the left, people in the center, like all Canadians, there's been different messaging catered to each of the demographics in Canada, each of the people from all political leanings to sell everybody, including many liberals themselves who are supporting this narrative that the Chinese evil CPC has put their puppet Justin Trudeau in power, had funded, there's claims like the Chinese government funded 12 Liberal Party candidates in 2019 and 2021, that there's a slew of these claims. The problem is all of these claims originated from CSIS reports. CSIS is sort of the Canadian version of the CIA, mm-hmm. A little bit newer. It was created in 1983 by Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the first Trudeau dictator of Canada.
Yeah.
And so this report is something nobody has seen. The CSIS report, nobody has seen it. It's classified. The only people who have gotten the security clearance to see it, say that there's nothing to it, but they refuse to make it public, which would resolve this problem very quickly. You could easily see if it were just made public, anybody could look at it and could objectively see, just like I did with the Safeguard Defenders report, is there evidence or is it just like shadowy, you know, anonymous claims with no evidence? But they're not doing that. They're keeping it classified. David Johnston created, you know, they tried to cook up this really lame story with a close friend of the Trudeau family named David Johnston, who is the former governor general, longtime Trudeau family friend going back to the 70s. And he was appointed to be the commissioner to, read the reports and then evaluate whether it was enough evidence was available to justify a thorough real commission to investigate it. And he said, no, I read it. There's nothing there. But then it's almost like they wanted that to fail to stoke the flames of drama because nobody was going to believe what this guy says anyway. So again, nobody's read it. Pierre Poilievre, who's the head of the Conservative Party, who is the opposition party of the Liberals, has said he's allowed to read it if he's brought into Privy Council. And, you know, he's a member of the Privy Council, just as every member of the shadow government and active government is. Canada's a weird thing that way. We have a governor general, privy councils, all these weird things tied to London. It's part of the way the actual mechanisms of power work in Canada. But he says, you know, if I went in to the room and read it, I wouldn't be allowed to speak of what I read in public anymore. So I'd rather speculate freely by not reading it and holding ignorant to right. what's in the content. So again, all of this stuff is just pushing, kindling onto the drama. So it made it difficult because I realized, well, shit, there's nothing to really make a video out of. It's just like claims I can't dig into them. So we're like, okay, let's just change the script entirely. We had to do a few rewrites. It was a pain in the ass, but we were like, okay, let's make this about like, what the hell is CSIS? Because we're all being told that this is the patriotic agency that cares so much about Canada's democracy that they dropped this, that they circulated their report to trusted members of the news media, Globe and Mail, Global TV, which is another right. big Canadian outfit. Ironically, both of which have received tons of money by the very little Liberal government that they're complaining about or exposing as a Chinese operation. They received over $600 million in 2021 by Justin Trudeau. So, I mean, it's right there. Even Epoch Times, frankly, is one of the news agencies that received tons of money from the Liberal government of Justin Trudeau. So, you know, it's that's just a fun little scandal there. But
that's
all
so
of these
bizarre. So I have. So let me ask. Okay, I want to like kind of engage with it a little bit. Is like yeah. so. We have this perception that in the U.S. that you know the Democrats are doing something with China and also that in Canada that Trudeau is doing something with China, and. We, it's like this whole kind of, it's been repeated so many times and so many people talk about it, that it, I guess it seems true because we hear it so much, but there are like, for example, the Biden family like has received a lot of money from China, not from, I mean, China's a big country with, you know, like a billion and a half people and there's lots of different interests because it's a big society. But there's something like $400 million or something like this, the Biden family, you know, in kickbacks or whatever, or it's whatever, however that is explained. So is there, what's going on with that? Is that business as usual or is that an illusion or, and then separate or connected to that with the case of Trudeau, so you're saying that the very same people that are accusing Trudeau of these things have actually been getting a lot of money that have been approved specifically by his government.
Yo, that's quite the irony, isn't it? Yeah. There's something like 800 different media outlets that got to drink from this pool of cash that was raised to sort of help facilitate messaging to the public under COVID health emergency stuff. So that was like... In reality, I mean, it was a giant bribe to just like get all of the media outlets on the same page and walk in lockstep on the messaging. As far as, yeah, like it's important not to oversimplify some of this stuff, in terms of white and black, but like in the case of Biden, you know, like you have, I think, some major missteps from China. On the one hand, people overlook the fact that China is engaged with their own battle against their own swamp and their own deep state. That's right. Part of what, you know, Xi Jinping has been engaged with for the past 10 years with this anti-corruption program that has put something like two different former security directors of China, a former justice minister, into prison for life.
Right.
You know, people like the reason why Peter Dowlin, who ran Safeguard Defenders, is no longer operating in China is because he was part of the massive purge of foreign agencies and foreign agents, many of whom had risen to great power, especially through Shanghai, which is sort of the British control zone that a lot of the billionaires, the highest density of billionaires is located around the Shanghai zone. And many of the agents that sort of are leaning towards the World Economic Forum outlook, like Jack Ma was a World Economic Forum trustee, are located in the Shanghai clique around
the
former.
AliExpress, Alibaba guy, right?
Yeah. And, you know, he's a super uber wealthy billionaire, kind of like a Chinese version of Bill Gates. And China's got a very different system because it's not really, they call themselves the Chinese Communist Party as the name of their party. But if you look at the system as a whole, it's really, you can't call it communist by any measure. Marx would like turn it in his grave if he was,
right.
If people were saying that, yeah, this is their representative of 21st century communism. But like, you know, China has just a situation where you could be an entrepreneur, you could be a businessman, you could be a billionaire, but you're not allowed to make policy. And as soon as, you know, Jack Ma went, I think people probably are familiar with this. He went he was in a very high level Chinese government affiliated meeting, and he basically called for a complete overhaul of the Chinese financial system around a World Economic Forum, associated type of digital banking that was tied to like a hardcore libertarian bent. He basically called for like a rallying of all of the influencers of China to like push for this reform. And at that point, he like disappeared for like 8 months. You know, like he was grabbed by the collar,
wow.
You know, stripped of all of his privileges and stuffed into his mansion and just told sit there as Alibaba was reorganized. It's still a weird thing. And now I think he's like teaching in Japan or something. And working with Bill Gates, actually. Jack Ma and Bill Gates or Bill Gates' wife, former wife, have created some sort of a new organization. It's weird. But to say that this represents, that Jack Ma represents China is a total fallacy and a lie. But China's been going through their own, you know, battle with their deep state, purging of the fifth columnists as much as they could. But it's still an issue. But on the other hand, you've got people like, I think Patrick Ho, who I'd actually listened to speak in 2015. I think he was a character who was China's naive on some core points. And I think, especially with Patrick Ho, who was the guy who was sort of assigned, he was the former, he was a high up executive in Hong Kong for a number of years before he became the head of this pro Silk Road think tank. And his job was go to African countries primarily, figure out what they need, like build relationships, as sort of this back channel, you know, private sector diplomacy guy, pay bribes. You know, every country has their own way of doing things. So if they do bribes in Nigeria or in most of the African or whatever country, you just do what you got to do to get the contracts, to build the bridges, you know, and integrate the economic relationships of those countries with the type of paradigm of the Belt and Road Initiative of long-term economic development. And over time, the idea was, okay, even these corrupt backwards countries will learn what their true self-interest is as a country that's able to increasingly produce for itself, take care of its own needs, you know, as a manufacturing nation, while building infrastructure. So that's the whole idea. But the naive, I think, major big fatal blind spot with Patrick Ho and whoever the hell he was like working with on mainland China was that when he went to the US, it was like, okay, go do the Africa plan. Like everything we've been doing that's been working so pretty well, you know, drop a suitcase here of money, find, figure out who makes the deals, who can facilitate, you know, contact with the business community, in politics. Just do what you do. And, you know, he went to, okay, he's like, okay, there's this guy who's really open for business, Joe Biden. I got to work through his son.
Right.
And Joe's brother was a big player in that and some other members of the family. And they're not dealing with the same kind of beast at all. Like they didn't realize what the hell kind of Byzantine structure of intrigue they were walking into, run by ultimately a British directed death cult that doesn't want development. They, you know, and so they, Patrick Ho went to jail and a lot of this stuff went public, both with the laptop and a bunch of other, points of detail that people can look into. So I think China really heavily misstepped, but then you see, but by virtue of misstepping, then the Steve Bannon's out there, the Epoch Times, other things can take that and then just easily run with the narrative like, oh, it's evidence that China runs the United States. They've been taken over, you know, and everything, that information is then reframed to ignore the higher context in which this is actually happening.
Right.
Yeah. So the sort of same thing with
Times isn't Epoch Times. They were very, very good on COVID in the U.S. Epoch Times was very, very good on Beltway politics also and lockdowns. But when when it comes to China, are they connected to the Falun Gong cult?
Yeah, that's right. And they're good on culture wars too. It's hard to not appreciate the content you can get from them on domestic politics and culture wars.
Yes.
Or anti-COVID stuff, anti-Great Reset stuff. It's generally sane. And that's what's attractive about this sort of thing is it's attractive and it is a breath of fresh air to see a media outlet speaking so well of these particularly, hot topics. But then as soon as they get your trust on this domain, all of a sudden it becomes literally making shit up on a broader geopolitical global perspective, especially in regards to China. And yeah, like you just said, the Falun Gong, groupings, the people who have been complaining that the Chinese government just loves their organs so much that they keep on stealing and eating their tasty, tasty, pure Falun Gong organs. It's really,
right.
They're the backer of it. To understand that, one has to look at, this fellow, well, New Tang Dynasty is the name of the umbrella organization that funds thousands of different platforms, cultural platforms, Epoch Times just being one of many, some for are into kids education. But New Tang Dynasty was created by the Falun Gong, and the Falun Gong itself is run by this character, strange but useful character to look into, who lives on a 400-acre estate, a compound in New York State. 420-acre compound, actually, named Li Hongji.
Mm-hmm.
And Li Hongji is a really weird character. He gave an interview with Time Magazine. I think it was like one of the last times they let him speak publicly. and people could even go to Time Magazine's archives and read this interview. I published it. Well, the juiciest parts of it, at least, in the appendix of our Breaking Free of Anti-China PSYOPs report. He describes himself as a new messiah fighting an intergalactic war of interdimensional and also beings that exist within our dimension as well. So different species of aliens who have been around, he says, for about 120 years, interfacing with the oligarchy, giving them powers.
Go on. Okay.
Yeah. And he is the chosen one, as he thinks of himself, whose purpose is to bring harmony to the global Jedi force of dark and light forces, and he has amongst his many powers telepathy, telekinesis, the ability to heal by thought, not just only touch, and these are things that he openly, you know, says that he has powers to. He describes these aliens as really wanting when the Times interviewer asks him, well, why do they want, human beings? Why do they want to use us so much? And he says, they love our bodies and they love our organs. They love our organs because we're made in the image of the God, the true God. He's very appealing his messaging to a lot of the Christians, the evangelical Christians who just want to hear that sort of thing. And he describes the golden section, the golden ratio around which the human organism is constructed, which is true. I mean, Da Vinci was working on this, and this is a fact that is a very divine thing, that we are the most perfect material organism. That's true. But then he says, but we, especially the Falun Gong, are the most divine of all. And that's why the Chinese CPC, which he alludes to, is in collusion with the aliens to suck the Falun Gong organs, most specifically, is the greatest of all gems of the universe. These people just then go out. They're very attractive to Westerners looking for purpose in life as a meditation Qigong cult grouping. But then when you go, when it seems to be organized, like many of these groups, around a sort of rite of initiation, and, you know, when you're tapped on the shoulder, you can go to a higher level. And at a certain point, you're, I don't know what goes on at the higher levels, but
what's the difference between Qigong and Falun Gong?
Well, Qigong is an ancient, Chinese meditation exercise that involves balancing your qi. Kind of like it sort of co-evolved, I think, along with yoga in India.
Yes.
And a recognition that we're these, we are these electromagnetic beings of light, which is true. I mean, science can even prove that. And our feelings have a psychosomatic and also physical effect upon our body. And when you bring your body into certain alignment using certain exercises.
This is very interesting. Because when you compare, for example, the strictly almost, it's atheist and strictly materialist philosophical framework of Chinese, of the ideology of the Communist Party. And you look at the things that Falun Gong is saying. I mean, obviously they have very many cult-like features, the exclusivity of the group, the exclusivity of the leader. It's them in particular that are chosen ones, et cetera. So that's very dangerous cult-like stuff. But broadly about the nature of human beings in the universe and stuff, like they tend to be kind of very, have a more interesting thing to say than the CPC does. Yet, the underlying geopolitics of it is very disconcerting.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Falun Gong got kicked out of China back in 1997.
Yes.
Because Li Hongji decided to organize a mass movement of his followers who had developed, he sort of came out of nowhere. In 1992, sort of like burst onto the scene just as the Soviet Union was collapsing, as the organizer of what was originally sort of a fringe, negligible cult that somehow had patronage and support both from the outside of China as well as from forces within China that just grew and grew in influence. And then he basically had an intervention to try to shut down Beijing and had his organizers or his devotees go to the streets and like block streets, have mass protests for days on end. And it became understood that it was a very disruptive institution and it was banned and he was kicked out and he was immediately given sanctuary, like I said, by the CIA and lived in his 400 acre compound as a billionaire. He kind of reminds me a little bit on the one hand of Fethullah Gulen, who runs his own weird cult in Turkey
and
has his own fifth columnist. Sort of the same thing. And Fethullah Gulen lives in like some giant compound in Philadelphia and sort of similar multi-billionaire pseudo-religious guru, but has a lot of business interests and cultural interests and has a lot of devotees in the Turkish government. Even today, some of them seem not to have been totally purged in 2016.
That's right.
Similar thing. And I think China also, they have a bit of a better memory of even the recent past. And when I say recent for us might be like what Richard Nixon working with Schultz to quote the dollar. For China, like recent past
when
might
said
be
recent, about, like, yeah, the 90s. You're like, I'm like, oh yeah, the 60s. Yeah, recent. Yeah.
Yeah, well, China's like probably their idea of recent might be something more like, the 1850s civil war of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, which this is very much reminiscent of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom operation. Like in the middle, during the Opium Wars, the Second Opium War, before and during, they were going through their own civil war crisis. And the reason why was there was this fellow who is a disciple of a few Jesuits, British and American, Jesuits and Jesuit collaborators, who are these evangelicals, based in, southern China, who trained this guy and got him, helped groom him to the point that he believed that he was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ's brother.
Jesus Christ's brother?
Brother. Yeah, that was a weird thing, right? As if, so they like have this whole weird Gnostic thing about like this.
Yeah.
It was weird, right? So they have a whole story.
Yeah,
so
yeah, pseudo, different theories, yeah.
It was like a pseudo Christian cult, that was sort of a precursor in some ways to, like that basically got rid of, private property. They created these communes, collectivization. It was a really weird thing. And, the guy had this belief that he had to bring in the new Taiping Heavenly Kingdom as a new dynasty to overthrow the Qing dynasty. And they ran a civil war for like 15 years. And again, he always had these weird British and American handlers, who are members and very tightly knit with the opium trading families of the Boston Brahmins and the British East India Company. And actually, a guy who was part of Frederick Engels' salons, forgetting his name now, Anton Chaikin goes through him really in depth in his Treason in America book back in 1984. Was the Viscount of the British in China at that time, who oversaw this operation. Forgetting his name, damn it. Anyway, this guy actually nearly won, and that was a big point that the British used to the Chinese government in the 1850s to say, look, if you don't give us everything we want, if you don't give us like Hong Kong, all of these other concessions, we will recognize the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom as the only legitimate government of China, which is the same threat they were doing at around the same time during the American Civil War, right? Basically saying that we are prepared to recognize the Confederate South as the only legitimate government. Thus,
yeah, the British were doing that.
British were doing that. So that was why Tsar Alexander II sent the Russian ships to the coasts of America, New York, and California in 1863.
Not a lot of people know that the Russians played a role in defeating slavery in the American South.
Yeah. Yeah, the great liberator Alexander II, who had liberated the serfs, 25 million, was very much cut from the same cloth as Lincoln.
So first he abolished slavery in Russia.
Yeah.
And then assisted the U.S. in abolishing slavery in the South.
Yeah. Yeah, and as was later revealed by an interview delivered from Alexander II to Wharton Barker, who is a banker, and he had a publishing house, but he published an interview with Tsar Alexander II, who said, you know, like, the reason why I did this is that I, not for any particular love of America, but I knew that without America, there would be not much to resist the United States. There would be not much available to resist Britain and British global intrigue as an international force, as well as the inability for us to work with another pro-industrial state that thought on the same wavelength as we did. Now that's not his words. You got to read his volume one of the Clash of the Two Americas that I wrote with my wife Cynthia. Has a chapter going through this where we cite all of these interviews, and we quote at length from Alexander II describing why he sent the Russian Navy as a message to the French and the British specifically that if they recognized the Confederate South as a legitimate government, which would bring them closer into a position where they would be able to militarily and legally support the Confederacy, even though they were doing it covertly, they would be able to do it overtly,
openly,
upon recognizing it as an authoritative, an actual government.
Government, yeah.
Then that would be casus belli with Russia, and that dissuaded at the time England and France from doing what they were threatening to do. But the same thing that they were doing to the United States to break up the U.S. was the same thing they were doing to China at the same moment, right? So all that to say, this was all done by synthetic cults masquerading as pseudo-Christian organizations that were organized by Western intelligence to disrupt China from within as part of the cultural warfare great game. So Li Hongji, the intergalactic messiah, who created this other thing, is really reminiscent of that same model. Like, I think the Chinese sort of picked up on that early on, and they're like, no, we can't have this in our midst, and expelled him. That's also where, like, you got these different clashes with these pseudo Catholic Christian organizations under Pope Francis, who's going to war with the Chinese government, and Pope Francis do not get along. There's a huge war right now over the fact that Francis wants control over the Catholic Church in China, and China's saying, no, no way. We're not going to let you do that.
I mean, the Catholic Church in China is effectively that would be called schismatic or something, right? I mean, it's not under the control of the Vatican.
Exactly.
It's kind of the Anglican Church of China or like something like that. I mean, it's...
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, the Bible is the same Bible. People say, oh, it's a different Bible. No, it's the Bible. It's translated into Chinese script. There's no like make believe, no adding anything new to it. People can complain or have debates about the meanings of various symbols within the context of where they arise, but There's just you don't have the liberty to just do whatever you want to do as the Catholic Church operations are concerned in China. They do have oversight, you know, that they have to still abide by.
Which, I mean, the Jesuits, before that, this is so people understand that we have within the church, within the Catholic Church, there was an understanding that a Jesuit would not be the Pope. And the present Pope is a Jesuit. So this is very, very weird, first of all. And the Jesuits did a big thing in China. They were trying to tamper. I mean, they may have succeeded, you know, Chinese history, Chinese culture. Like there was lots of fires in libraries and things that Jesuits were involved in revisionism in China. Not what Mao means by revisionism, but of historical revisionism. And it's on the one hand, you can understand that Catholics in China would want their church to be in full communion with the Vatican. On the other hand, the trade-off, unfortunately, is that you open yourself up to these Jesuit agents who come in and start to try to undermine the sovereignty of your country. Or, you know, you can see, for example, the games that the Catholic Church has been playing with the Orthodox Church in Russia, for example, right? So you kind of have this thing. Also, another point for folks to connect some dots. So you have Alexander, just kind of backing up on the Alexander II thing. What people may also need to understand is that, so the Civil War was happening, but just a few years before that, there had been the Crimean War, and the Russians had just had to defeat France and England and the Ottomans in Crimea. And Alexander II and Nicholas I were commanders and leaders in that conflict against the UK and France. So this is almost like, so you have the American Civil War is happening just, you know, 8 years or something after the end of the Crimean War.
Yeah, exactly. And that those should all be seen as this, as different parts of the same thing.
Same conflict, exactly. Yeah, like a world war, yeah. Really.
Yeah, exactly. It really is that. And like the uprisings in India that saw the British really have a headache on their hands. Like the British had been in India now for, you know, it had only just recently been made the crown jewel. But they had an 1860 uprising of the Indians of all walks of life, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, all together, who fought against the British over the course of many, many months. The British had to allocate a lot of their resources to putting that down at the same time as they're fighting the Chinese Opium War, that they're supporting the Chinese Civil War, that they've just like put a huge amount of resources into sucking, tricking Russia into falling into this this Crimean War with the French and the Ottomans. And I mean, yeah, Russia misstepped. They should have known better than to walk into that one. And then at the same time as they're funding the Confederate Civil War, and the same time that they're pushing for Juarez, so you have the overthrow of Benito Juarez in Mexico, who's also dealing with his own City of London directed operations inside of, and then all of like Latin America. You got a Habsburg,
yeah,
Napoleon,
Porfirio Diaz. Yeah, right.
Oh man, it's a global war, like you said. It really should be called the First World War, right?
People don't always appreciate, in fact, is that the U.S. and Russia have been on the same side of most of these global conflicts, including both world wars in the 20th century.
Yeah, and the American Revolution itself, too. Like, it was Russia that was leading the League of Armed Neutrality, that was helping, that was largely responsible for ensuring the goods and supplies and weapons and munitions that would make it into the hands of American fighters against the British Empire from Europe. So that was entirely the British Empire today. Oh, it's super strong. In one way, it's super strong. In another way, it's super weak, right? Because it's much harder for people to recognize the power structures of Britain's invisible empire.
They control Canada. They totally control Canada, right?
Yeah, the whole Five Eyes Commonwealth. And I guess this could like help us sort of vector back into sort of the substance of the documentary. Which moves, like I said, from kind of election interference into like, what the hell is CSIS? Is it really this patriotic agency? What is the Five Eyes that CSIS is a part of? You know, so what is the Five Eyes? Services. Yeah, exactly. And And CSIS, just so people may not be aware, it's literally, it stands for Canadian Security Intelligence Services. Yeah, like you said. And then, it works closely with another organization called the Canadian Communications Establishment. Canadian Communications Security Establishment. They sound the same. They're two sort of different agencies that work closely together, kind of like the NSA, which works with the FBI and CIA. So, that's what is CSIS, and we also address in this video how does the Five Eyes interface with NATO, which involved going back in time a little bit to the creation, like why was NATO created? Why was the Five Eyes created? So that begins a starting point. The starting point we've chosen in the video was the dangerous alliance of the US-Russian-China alliance of 1944-45 that had been carefully organized by patriots of all of those three nations. Well, maybe China was a little bit weaker because, unfortunately, Franklin Roosevelt was duped into believing that Chiang Kai-shek could be a viable partner in, bringing a new system online after World War II. FDR was heavily, badly, badly advised on that point. Chiang Kai-shek turns out to be a complete corrupt jackass. Wouldn't have been a very viable partner. But anyway, you did have an idea coming out of Bretton Woods that the New Deal and the reform of the banking system that was done to great success inside of the United States and the large-scale mega projects that increased the productive powers of labor, the industrial output of the United States, and helped the U.S. build economic sovereignty up to the point that they would be able to become a partner with other nations like Russia who were doing serious battle with the Nazi Wehrmacht. And that productive power was made possible by the battles against Wall Street and the City of London starting in 1933. It was an ongoing battle the whole time. It was never easy for Roosevelt. He avoided two assassination attempts, a military coup. But he saw eye to eye with Stalin because both Roosevelt and Stalin both had to deal with active fifth columnist deep state operatives. In the case of Stalin, it was obviously the Trotskyist freaks who are always loyal to the British fascist high command and were, trying to do business with the Japanese and the German Nazis and all these things as part of carving up the world into jurisdictions for a new world order. And in America, it was, the United States FDR had to deal with his own Rhodes Scholar, Fabian Society
Fifth Column model. The Trotsky's model is the Eric Blair model that you see in 1984.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, except maybe, yeah. And the fact that so many of these followers, these devotees of Trotsky in America, like Sidney Hook and, James Burnham and James Wohlstetter, and Irving Kristol, all of these guys who in the 30s and 40s, early 40s, or at least 30s, were up until like months before Trotsky's murdered, they all go on to become the founding fathers of the neoconservative movement. They're all the ones who are trying to keep the United States out of World War II. Because the whole idea was that, the Trotskyists are going to become ultimately victorious in Russia. They will kill the nationalists who have, organized themselves around Stalin and bring themselves back into some sort of a collaborative position with the Nazis and the other fascist agencies of Britain who, you had a fascist king waiting to be brought back into power. King Edward the Eighth, who was, in Portugal the whole, during World War II saying, I'll be your Nazi king again. You had Oswald Mosley, you had Lloyd George, both were Nazi wannabe prime ministers of World War II saying, we're ready to come in and be the Nazi prime ministers.
Right. And the very interesting people, exactly like Mosley, before going on to form the British Union of Fascists, formed the left wing of the Independent Labor Party that was pro-Trotskyist. So that's
exactly.
So,
yeah.
So people don't know that Mosley went from Leninism to Trotskyism to fascism.
And he was a Fabian the whole time too. He was openly working with the Fabian Society, which are like,
that's part of his title.
Right. And that's part of like the Fabian Society. That's what people see. Most Westerners today have been trained to oversimplify the very complex idea of socialism into like one thing. Yeah. And it's so much more complex than people realize. And what the socialism that most Westerners hate and fear rightly so is the Davos, you know, Green New Deal socialism of that masquerades as capitalism, but it's really feudal capitalism. It's feudal socialism. It's really Fabian socialism. It's run by a bunch of anti-human misanthropes, which is what the Fabian Society always were, who create an attractive honey-coated net for the disenfranchised and abused labor and poor to then fall into the net and then weaponize the poor so that they become instruments of their own eugenics future.
And independency and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so they hate the masses that they profess to, like, champion. And so these elitists like Mosley, Sir Oswald, and George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells and
James Vernon, and Max Shackman.
Oh my God, yeah. These guys are terrible. And, yeah. But they all become, the fact that they all become then right-wing, hardcore, anti-Soviet neocons, like more McCarthy than McCarthy in the Cold War. Yeah, very telling and very much, it's not surprising when you look at it from this standpoint that they only saw Trotsky or Trotskyism as a useful,
as a vehicle.
As a vehicle, yeah, to achieve ultimately this sort of like, end of world government and a managerial revolution as James Burnham calls it, you know, his ideal society. It's a managerial society where there is no real democracy. People are just well behaved and you get some like, you know, add-ons to it with Aldous Huxley's concepts of Soma and these things that are infused into their design, but it's all the same thing. So why am I saying this?
We have a feedback from a reader, from a listener who's saying that they have maybe you can weigh in on this. They're saying the Catholics are grumbling that the Pope is not choosing the bishops in China like he does everywhere else. The Chinese state has a say in this. Actually, Francis got the ball rolling on this, and the trad Catholics hate him for it, which is why Bannon, rabid trad Catholic, is so anti-China with his role in Epoch Times. So yeah, so Bannon backs the Epoch Times stuff. You know, I almost thought at first that Bannon was behind Epoch Times, and like, oh, it's this Chinese group. It was very strange.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting what your listener is saying. And yeah, it's important. And Bannon's role, I recently wrote an article for The Last American Vagabond. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out, and I highly recommend people check this out. It's called Steve Bannon and China's Deep State. You can put my name in with that title and you'll get it.
Steve Bannon and China's Deep State.
Yeah, China's in bed. Like the actual deep state of China, the thing that's taken over the British-directed – the Anglo-American directed deep state operation that's been working to like subdue humanity under a global feudal empire of neo-Trotskyist sort of like structures, a managerial sort of great reset. Those same operatives who are built up in China to undermine China from within as a viable civilizational state are in bed with Bannon. They're the ones working with Bannon. Like Miles Guo is a character I go through in quite a lot of detail in that article. And Miles Guo was a guy who escaped getting arrested in 2015 inside of China. He was a multi-billionaire. He ran Zenith Enterprises, a branch of the JP Morgan operation in China. It was called like Morgan Beijing or something that he also ran as a real estate financier, investment banker. And he was actually early on, he was working with this guy, who later ran Apple Daily, whose name I'm forgetting, a big funder of the Hong Kong protest movement of 2015 and 2019. That guy, right? Went to jail in 2021.
Yes. It was a case.
I'm forgetting his name anyway, but yeah, he was a big bankroll originally, this Apple Daily billionaire of, the Tiananmen Square Soros CIA operation that tried to bring in a new Maidan and, a new Chinese Trotskyist in the form of, Zhao Ziyang, who you and I have spoken about in the past.
Yes.
Who is a tool of George Soros and the CIA. He's known as the Gorbachev of China, Zhao Ziyang. And he was supposed to be the guy who would sweep in as the great savior of the people. And clean up the Politburo and be brought in sort of as a Pinochet-like liberalizer of the economy that would privatize everything of China in the 1990s, which is what he said he was going to do had he been successful. But that was Tiananmen Square for you.
Yeah, we use a funny language on our channel so that people kind of understand the process. It's in developing countries, nationalization is sovereignization. In developing countries, often privatization
is actually the opposite of what you would think it would be, because it doesn't place the control into the hands of the people where they can buy it. It places the control into foreign corporations or foreign governments or foreign Rothschild investors, whatever, right? So we, yeah, so people understand, like, in the developmental model, countries have to nationalize or socialize big industry to keep it out of the hands, not necessarily of oligarchs within the country. That could be manageable perhaps, right? But to actually keep it out of the hands of foreign oligarchs that want, as imperialists, that would want, that don't even care about you, that just want to just sort of pump and dump or whatever they're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what they intended to do with China had the Maidan been the successful color revolution. The Tiananmen Square, had that been the successful color revolution that it was in the Philippines, or it was later on in the Maidan in Ukraine, that would have been the fate. It would have been a more like Russian perestroika glasnost fate of China in the 90s. But the Chinese were able to rally their patriots sufficiently to kick out Soros back then, to put Zhao Ziyang into prison, strip him of all. This guy was the head of the Chinese Communist Party, right? That's no small deal.
This is inside the communists. This is the deep state in China.
Yeah.
They were post, this is like Deng, you know, the things that Deng did were very important, Deng Xiaoping. But then moving forward, there's people who then took those openings and they went to the British Empire and said, hey, how can we help you put me in power and trade you China in return? You know?
Yep.
And then you had Hu Jintao and the whole. Now I have a question for you, which is effectively, can we consider you an honorary American?
I'm a Republican, that's for sure. I mean, I guess, if you want to, you're an American, so you have the right to, I guess, induct me, right?
So we can confer that, yeah. We're going to get back to China, but just so you will understand, Americans tend to think that Canada is just like another America, but it's north of us. You guys don't have a Constitution, Bill of Rights. You guys are subjects of the Crown, not technically anymore, or are you? Or what's really going on? Is it a fake country? What's up with your flag?
Yeah, it's a fake country. With some viable historic, like I did a deep study for a few years to try to make sense of Canada, and the effect of it was the Canadian Patriot magazine that I created in 2012.
Right.
Thanks. The idea was to just, you know, I couldn't find anybody who wanted to publish the research that I was pulling together. I was very excited, you know, about some of the historical discoveries that were all very, fitting together super well, because I basically, at the time I was working with the LaRouche organization, and one of the things that people might have noticed about the LaRouche organization is there's a lot of emphasis on the British Empire as a still existent phenomenon in global politics. And I was like, well, I'm saying this to people, but here I am in Canada, and I got involved with them in 2006, and I was like a volunteer, you know, doing a lot of organizing, and I'm like, I'm saying this and I get it. I sufficiently began to understand how this works for the United States takeover and how the U.S. has been under the control of this foreign agency since JFK was murdered. And I was like, okay, I can wrap my mind around that, but I still don't get Canada. We're still a monarchy. We still have a Privy Council. Like, are we a democracy? Like, how does this apply to Canada? And for the 40 years that the LaRouche organization had been active in Canada, they're always like small little offices, never more than a couple dozen people at a time. Nobody ever really seems to have done the work of just like proving that that's true, or why is that true in Canada? Like, how does Canada work? What is our history? Nobody did the damn work. And I was like, well, if I'm going to organize in Canada, if I'm going to go to Ottawa and like have meetings with diplomats or try to meet with members of parliament or even organize citizens to take responsibility for the oncoming collapse and doing something, I should probably know what is the terrain I'm operating in and that I'm expecting them to operate in. Rather than just saying like, oh, go, you know, go kick out Dick Cheney from Canada or something. Like that's disempowering and stupid. Like, why would I say that? So that research, a few people felt the frustration I felt, and we put together a lot of this history, and I couldn't find anybody to publish it. And I was getting annoyed because it was a great story of our, it's like a new macro narrative that takes into consideration the fact that we've always been a weapon used by the British Empire as part of the British toolkit to destabilize Russian American friendship and run anti-American operations from British basing operations in Canada from the Civil War, even before that, all the way to the murder of JFK. So, you know, and then also it's not just all bad, because then you start appreciating when you start looking at this ugly fact of, or this sort of bitter quality of our history, you start seeing that, oh shit, all of the things I enjoy, the hydroelectric power, the abundance that I enjoy, didn't happen because the empire gave it to us. It always happened because you had a Republican-minded person who achieved political power in the 19th century, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, right. 50s, 60s, 70s, who fought like hell against the Malthusian British-directed Rhodes Scholarship operation. And there's always been Rhodes Scholars and Fabians running, trying to keep us underdeveloped, backwards, better, easy to manage and control.
It's a misanthropic ideological cult, so people understand. It's a misanthropic eugenicist ideological cult. I know it's hard for people to kind of understand that history can operate with these things in there, but just to kind of give a short definition.
Yeah, it's kind of like a universal constant of the attributes of oligarchs, right. Is they have what you just said. That's one thing that they're religiously wired by. And will always act in a court, like a cat will always be a cat. Whatever the environment is you put the cat into, it'll act like a cat. An oligarch will always predictively act like an oligarch according to these attributes. And that's one of them. They will sabotage development of people that allow us to tap into our deeper potentials by actualizing new discoveries and the fruits and new technologies to overcome limits to growth. They will always try to sabotage that. And if they can't sabotage that, they will act like they like it to the degree that they can get close to the control of what is the science or technology that they say that they like, only with the intent of hollowing it out, controlling the narrative of science itself, and then undermining it from within later on, like they do with everything. If you can't destroy it, you get close to it, and it's the Delphic technique. You model yourself on it on surface, but you then destroy the substance of what makes it happen. Whether it's a nation, right. Whether it's the church, whether it's a government, whether it's whatever, that's what they do.
You read the thing that you want to destroy.
Exactly. So that's what they did to the United States by making everyone believe that the U.S. is just this one-dimensional empire built on hypocrisy and slavery and corruption, and it's never been anything good. And they forget, people forget the beautiful origins of the U.S. And they did the same thing with science itself. And they said, oh yeah, see, science is just, you know, this thing we define it as this descriptive mathematical thing that Bertrand Russell, the positivist, says it is.
Why? That's the guy who wrote Why I'm Not a Christian.
And, that guy.
And exactly. That book, people will know that book. And what's very interesting about Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian, as an aside, to piggyback on what you're saying here, is that if you read it, you will encounter all of the same arguments that, you know, if you were like a precocious middle school student when you were like 12, 13, or 14, like all of the atheist arguments that a person that's never talked to a religious person comes up with are the things that Bertrand Russell says. So if you were an eighth or ninth grade atheist like I was, like I knew Bertrand Russell's arguments because those were just logical arguments to me. I wouldn't read that book until it was like required reading in university 10 years later, you know, and I was like, oh, I remember all these, you know, because they're the most like, if God can do anything, can he make a rock that he can't pick up? And that's supposed to be proof that God doesn't exist. Those are Bertrand Russell's arguments. They're totally lowbrow. It's very strange considering how exalted he is as some kind of brilliant philosopher. And don't get me started with Karl Popper and his extreme naive empiricism and ultra positivism.
This is why I love talking to you, Joaquin. You're able to bring a new dimension to these discussions that I'm not used to having as an interlocutor. That's cool. Yeah, that's right. And you know, one thing also of interest, piggybacking on what you just said, nothing what Bertrand Russell is bringing to the table is really all that new. A lot of the peripatetics and a lot of the philosophers, the scholastics were also talking about these sorts of logical absurdities. Back in the medieval era, even, you know, like these are not new things, but right. He popularized it, and he was a high level grand. Like, I mean, the guy was a Cambridge apostle, leader of the Cambridge Apostles. You know, he was an early, one thing that came up in my wife's research on James Burnham was when Burnham breaks from Trotsky, he writes a letter to Comrade Trotsky saying, why he no longer believes in Trotsky's dialectic materialism. And he says, I've learned, Comrade Trotsky, if you'd like me to give you a reading list, I will give you one. But I have learned from Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica that your dialectic materialism is an obsolete fraud. And I am now, and he basically describes his devotion to Bertrand Russell and specifically Russell's Principia. And people that might confuse or fall under the radar of a lot of people who might not realize the importance of what he just said, because
yes, myself Russell, included. Please continue. Yes.
I can do that. What Russell is doing is more than an academic mathematical exercise, because the Principia he co-writes with Alfred North Whitehead, another Cambridge disciple, apostle, by the way. These Cambridge apostles are very high level. So is John.
Wait,
John
back up and explain so people can kind of take a mental note. So, because sometimes these are proper nouns. Okay.
Yeah.
A Cambridge apostle is what?
Every year in Cambridge, I don't know when this began, centuries and centuries ago, there, as part of the grooming process of creating the next generation of managers of empire, there was an institution created kind of like a much higher level version of the Skull and Bones called the Cambridge Apostles. It's a grouping of 12 students, 12 positions at every year are available to those who will be selected from amongst the children of oligarchical families. Generally, very rarely is it somebody who comes from outside of one of the families unless they exhibit an immense amount of talent.
So it's like a dean's list for rich kids or?
Yeah, kind of, who are then like groomed into the higher mysteries of like mass epistemological warfare, shaping the zeitgeist, what are the techniques of mind control, epistemological.
So it has aspects like Rhodes Scholar then too.
Rhodes Scholars are like lower level doers, you know, like as they
say,
the Oxford and London School of Economics are where they groom and create the doers of empire, whereas Cambridge is where they create and groom the thinkers of the empire, the creative planners, right?
That explains a lot just right there, because it's clearly dry of ideas.
Yeah, it's a war of ideas. It's a battle of the mind, and it's the war of ideas. Very few people, even amongst the higher echelons of the oligarchical management, are, I think, aware in full of what the role is that they're playing in a broader grand strategy, right? They're all given narratives that fit their status or the role that they're expected to play as tools. Some might have a very grandiose role, you know, like Li Hongzhi believes that he is the Messiah. Obama had a Messiah complex. As such, they made good cult leaders. Jim Jones, lower level, but same thing. But everybody has a sort of narrative, and you have narratives that are higher for the elites, and elites amongst the elites have their own narrative. But very few, I think, are very self-aware of the actual game. And I think from my analysis, members of the Cambridge Apostles are among the few who are very self-aware of the game that they're playing. And you can see that by like, what was Bertrand Russell's first assignment? After becoming a teacher at Cambridge, after leaving university, the first book he publishes is the authoritative book on Leibniz and how Leibniz's mind works and how Leibniz, discovered what he did. Now, the book itself, I've read it. It's a bunch of garbage because I've also read Leibniz. I've actually read Leibniz. That was one of the things I'm grateful for in my association with the LaRouche organization for many years. Was it gave me an opportunity to sit down over years and years. Like we'd go full days throughout the week reading original writings of people who made discoveries. And it's a really good exercise to try to replicate what was Leibniz investigating? How was his mind working when he was like wrestling with paradoxes of nature and generating creative solution concepts that generated the infinitesimal calculus? Or even, you know, he was a really universal thinker. Or Kepler, how did he discover what he discovered as far as the coherence of the planets around the sun? You know, like who's.
But what
anyway.
We're talking about is how Bertrand Russell misinterprets or misrepresents Leibniz.
Leibniz. Yeah, and he basically says Leibniz, you know, he creates this concoction, this like Gnostic sort of interpretation of like Leibniz's bio saying, you know, he had two truths, one for the surface appearance and one for his inner truth, where he did everything for personal hedonism, but he acted like he was a virtuous lover of humanity, but that was only to get money from the kings who were naive. And he, like, just this garbage shit. They do the same thing with, that's what the Straussians do for Plato, for example. They say, oh yeah, Plato or Socrates right. had two discourses, one for the masses, one for the elite. And in truth, the true Plato is actually Thrasymachos from book one of the Republic, who just says the greatest good is the greatest hedonism, and the greatest evil is only physical pain. He's like that's really who Socrates, aka Plato, is.
They flip around the characters, and
they do the same thing for everybody. So they did that. That's what Bertrand Russell does for Leibniz. He does it then for Riemann. He writes a book redefining Riemann and like what Riemann was as a mathematician, basically taking away all the physical science that Riemann actually discovered and just saying, no, he was just playing with mathematical numbers games and probability theory. Nothing based upon discovering the laws of the boundary conditions shaping physical space-time, which is actually what Riemann was doing as a follower of Leibniz, who believed devoutly in God and God's creation as something which we are mandated to tune ourselves to if we're true lovers of truth and humanity. That's like Leibniz and Riemann for you. These guys are like the highest quality of loving souls. But Bertrand Russell is extracting that, right? And so these are like the first two books that this guy is writing. And then with the Principia Mathematica, which again, Bernheim says is what convinced him that Trotsky was outdated. It's basically taking the worst elements of dialectic materialism, which is basically, I think, from my view, the Achilles heel, the worst thing in DIMAT is the idea that quantity always shapes qualities, which Trotsky is trying to, because Trotsky is, you know, in the 20s when he's overseeing the new economy policy, basically like perestroika of the 90s in Russia was done already in the 20s under Trotsky to liberalize and, like, you know, privatize Russia on behalf of Armand Hammer and other Western bankers. He's also in control of from 24 to 25. Trotsky's in control of the Russian science and industrial policy, and he gives a speech saying, you know, like, we have to be acceptable scientists. We all have to accept that quantity always shapes qualities. And it's this disgusting speech saying that Mendeleev didn't even know that he was a follower of DIMAT, but he really was. And anyway, it's a whole convoluted thing.
Right. Right. No, just to give people some background in what you're saying, so we're keeping up here, is that dialectical materialism is the idea actually come up with by a guy named Dietzkin, but they acknowledge that, but then Marx and Engels basically develop it from Dietzkin. And the main idea, is that within a thing, within a process, it's kind of taking the ideas of Hegel and turning it on its head. And it's saying that within the world, anything as quantitative changes are occurring to it, that quantitative changes inevitably create a qualitative change. Now, there are many instances where you can find that operating, but to universalize that as the fundamental principle is a grave error, because there are things which can grow and grow and grow and don't change in quality. So they focus on examples of the things which do change, that do change qualitatively as a result of quantitative change. And then they use those examples to the exclusion of others to lead it to a false argument. Anyway, just to give people that, you know, to understand what you're saying.
That's a useful little summary. Yeah. And so to tie this back now to, so that's what Trotsky's trying to, like, impose. That's what all of his followers are trying to, like, sort of infuse into their own approach to infiltrating their respective governments, especially in the United States. Now, okay, so Bernheim says, I'm getting rid of Trotsky to follow Bertrand Russell's Principia. So in Principia, what's Bertrand Russell doing? It's a three-volume work that attempts to universalize linear mathematical logic with the idea that you could reduce every property of creation in space and in time to a limited set of axioms and postulates, limited, like a finite quantity of assumptions, core fundamental assumptions.
Like a Cartesian
kind of like a Cartesian graph, yeah. But yeah, Cartesian system that has certain assumptions about like a linear XYZ grid that shapes the entire universe in which everything exists, right? On a timeline that is linear, before which there was nothing, after which there will be nothing, right? So bounded, and so that's, so the Bertrand Russell system is like, okay, let's put symbolic symbols onto everything that physically qualitatively exists can be expressed in a symbol that itself can be understood through mathematical linear logic and reducible to a finite number of axioms, which is a challenge that was put forth a few years earlier by this guy, David Hilbert, at a international mathematics conference in like 1900. So Bertrand Russell's like, okay, I did it. And he did the three volumes with Whitehead. Saying, okay, now we have just proven with this guidebook that everything in all systems can be mathematized, symbolized, reduced to limited axioms. And with that, if we could just get all of the data into our models, it's kind of like a proto computer, you could then linearly extrapolate into the future and into the past everything that will ever happen and everything that has ever happened if you just have the empirical data. It's kind of like a radical positivism. That you have just universalized.
Okay, so it's Laplace's daemon.
Laplace's daemon. Laplace's daemon, exactly. It's the same thing. So yeah, he basically takes just a more sophisticated version of Laplace's daemon. And so the problem here is that, Kurt Gödel, a friend of Einstein, discovers an Achilles heel to that. Basically, whenever you introduce a self-referential in any system, basically, in short, Kurt Gödel proves in a very coherent way in his incompleteness theorem that all systems demand something outside of the system that cannot be contained within the system, both in mathematics, but also in ontological reality. Kurt Gödel is, by the way, a true follower of Leibniz.
This gets into set mathematics and sets.
Yeah. And Bertrand Russell has a very flat definition of the sets that he's trying to put the universe, box the universe into, whereas people like Riemann or Cantor, at least the early Cantor or later on Max Planck and Gödel, are looking at the physical boundary conditions of reality shaping what can on a lower order be described descriptively mathematically, sort of the way one would imagine shadows describing the cause that projects onto the shadows. So math is
You can use inductive reasoning from the lower order manifestation to then induce from there the higher order reasoning behind it or overarching it.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And you have to have a flexible mind because when dealing with what Leibniz calls because Leibniz in his dynamics, in his Specimen Dynamicum, and also Max Planck in his Principles of Philosophy, both deal with this in their own language. That there's two different states of reality. There's the higher reality of being that Plato discusses, and then there's the lower reality of becoming, of change, of flux. And the true scientist can't just do one or the other, but rather flexibly acknowledge both, but have them in their proper place. So like Leibniz calls one mechanical causation, the other one final causation. So,
there's like linguistic distinctions, but at the end of the day,
it's different ontological rules, or they're two different ontologies that coexist, but one is in a state where you, like, for example, if somebody is driving a car and hits a woman and an investigator is like, well, why did that happen? Well, it's useful to look at the weight of the car, the trajectory of the car, the speed, the velocity, the weight of the woman to see like, well, the mechanics are useful. And you could sort of obviously do that ad infinitum, right? There's always more data that you could glean from the, the density of the rubber and tire.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to ignore that stuff. But you don't want to overvalue its role in causing the process. So the how.
That's not why the car hit the ride. That's the how instead of the why. or the why instead
yeah,
of
and
the
then
how,
the why right? might be like a true investigator is looking at, well, the fact that, oh shit, that guy driving it is the boyfriend of the woman who got hit, and he was like, you know, discovered
right,
or
it was on
with
purpose,
his brother
yeah.
like that
right,
morning.
Right. Okay. Oh, he wanted to do it. That's why. It's like, yeah, well, exactly. the velocity of the car multiplied by the weight of the right. Is that, okay. So, I think we swallowed the lead though, is that there's actually, and I don't want to use the word conspiracy, but I think for folks to kind of grasp, because we can communicate at like this, but what you are explaining actually is a perversion or derailing that happened in the sciences, even going back to the 16 and 1700s, this fight goes actually going back for several thousand years. But this is actually where the actual development of science shows very clearly that this is an ordered universe, that this is a structured universe, and a created universe created by a benevolent creator. Whereas there's the attempts, and what the dominant paradigm is being controlled by is this anti-science parading as science that is intentionally hiding the data not so much the data, the arguments, the philosophy, the ontological aspect of it. So not necessarily the epistemic framework, but the entire ontology of this is actually meant to divert, distract, disguise the actual nature of the physical domain that we exist in.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. And the overemphasis of the lower order into, like, cause the question is who leads and who follows in the dance, right, of math and physics, or of quantity and quality. And the oligarchical sort of technique that they definitely are led to understand this quite well in places like, if you're a member of the Cambridge Apostles, you know, or a high level member of Thomas Huxley's X Club or something, you know, the idea is you can always create a sleight of hand by putting mathematics and the quantitative considerations of the universe that derive from simply mathematics being just sort of a one-dimensional, you know, more and less, you know, idea onto a universe that has actually many more higher qualities that can't be understood through simply that lens. But you can always dupe people then that way by mathematizing things. And, you know, obviously in the newer age, especially with the quantum world opening up, there was sort of the idea that we could only know things if positivism and determinism broke down from classical empiricist mathematics, then we could only know things via probability theory, like where the science of maybes, right? The rolling of the dice science, which was then applied to Darwinian mutations or the behavior of where the electron was going to be, which you couldn't know because as soon as you look at an electron, you change its velocity or its position. So, you know, there's this whole idea that all we could know is
that
like
Schrodinger's cat or what?
Yeah, that Schrodinger sort of he became a devotee of Bertrand Russell by the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And stopped believing in ontological truth.
Right.
And just, yes, that was Schrodinger's sort of, because Schrodinger was earlier on a much more potent, more Leibnizian mind who believed in ontological truths, and then he lost it. Whereas Gödel didn't lose it. Now here's the interesting thing that gets us back to Gödel, because Gödel proves the whole Principia is based on a fallacious foundation. Alfred North Whitehead is more sophisticated and maybe a little bit more honest than Russell and says, you're right, we made a mistake. And, you know, he adapts to the new obvious reality that Gödel brings to the surface. Bertrand Russell never forgives Gödel ever. And never acknowledges that he actually was ontologically in error. Gödel later on dies in 1975 or 4 of starvation because he's convinced that Bertrand Russell is running an international Freemasonic plot to destroy Leibniz, cover up science, and kill him through poisoning. And his wife, unfortunately, he only trusts his wife to take care of his meals, and she gets sick one week, goes to the hospital, and he has been driven kind of loopy at this point and dies of starvation instead. But is he wrong to think that Bertrand Russell is doing all these things? No, I think he was probably onto something.
Right. It's when you're under attack, you can become paranoid and these attacks can actually drive you or push you past the edge. But you actually are being gang stalked. You actually are being attacked. You actually are being followed. You actually are being derailed. So yeah, this is a known process. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now here's a fun punchline that ties a lot of this stuff together around the Trotskyists who become neocons and why Burnham becomes a follower of Russell and the Principia. Okay, so it comes around cybernetics. So one of Russell's disciples at Cambridge in 1913 when he's finalizing volume 3 of the Principia is a young guy named Norbert Wiener, who is brought into the, Russell has a small grouping of young boys who just worship Russell, who follow him around. They probably give him fellatio and stuff. As all of these philosophy, these William Yandel Elliott groupings, Lord Milner's kindergarten, they all do this, right?
Actually, this is one of the things, not to stop you there, but so people understand that type of hedonism and those types of things actually are one of the glues that hold these groups together at a social level.
Yeah, it's like a Theban Spartan male, warrior, groupings who are all like humping each other at night and fighting at day and stuff. It's weird. But so this guy Norbert Wiener is like this mathematical prodigy kid brought into Cambridge, becomes a Russell boy, and then takes it upon himself to manifest a practical science around the guideline of Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica, so Russell creates the broad framework, but then challenges his disciples to now make this a practical science of control that we can use to manage the empire.
Well, let me just say, so I can help you, I want to get I'm trying to extract something from you. Like the facts of that are very important. Don't get me wrong, but could you focus on the error in the ontology itself? Because we know that these people exist and different people wrote different things in different years, but in terms of the universe of ideas, in the abstract, but with reference to theirs though, how would you summarize, if you would, like the ontological error?
Okay. I would do it through the practical example of what Trotsky lies about regarding, because Trotsky's doing something similar to what Bertrand Russell is doing through his scientific, his attempt to impose this cage onto science, Russian science, specifically with the figure of Mendeleev. Now, people can read Mendeleev's Principles of Chemistry, and you can get it on archive.org. And I suggest reading the first 40 pages or so, just to get in the spirit of Mendeleev's self-description of his method. He's a Platonic thinker of a very high order. He's extremely Christian, and he's a scientist, these are not incompatible things. Now, Trotsky would say, or Russell would also say, that the periodic table of elements is a great example of why mathematical considerations shape qualities. By simply adding electrons around the orbits of atoms, of nucleuses, you get heavier and qualitatively different identities of elements on the periodic of Mendeleev's table.
It's an example of, and they use that to demonstrate the table of elements, the periodic table, that an increase in quantity changes the quality. Okay, just to establish referencing back.
Here's the paradox. Here's the juicy paradox. When Mendeleev discovered this in like 1867, when he came upon his discovery of the harmonic ordering of the periodic, of what we call in the West periodic table, but in reality Mendeleev's table, he didn't know that electrons existed. It took still many years, some like 35 more years before people actually had an idea of the electron per se. But he discovered it anyway without this knowledge. So what was he doing? Well, we could read Mendeleev and his own writings to see how he describes what he was doing, because he doesn't lie to us. He tells us. And he's looking for the musicality shaping space-time that would have some harmony and symmetry. And he does it. And he's looking at the crystallization of different elements. He's looking at how they combine with each other. He's intersectional in his thinking. He doesn't isolate himself to one narrow, a myopic, specialization. He's a poet himself, right? He's an economist. He's actually he's studying he goes to the United States to lead the the Russian delegation in 1876. He goes to Philadelphia to study the American system of political economy, leading the Russian delegation, and he comes back and is assigned by Alexander II to chair the Committee for the Protective Tariff of Russia against British free trade. And he polemicizes eloquently. I got his one of his speeches in the appendix of volume one of my Clash of the Two Americas. He polemicizes against British free trade and in defense, not just of protectionism, of following the Lincoln model, but also he maps out. He's like, we can better grow our industrial sovereignty, but he calls for the mapping out both of the mining resources using his understanding of the periodic table, like how this helps us now understand and how to map out our mining. He's a polymath, and also the industrial and educational reforms he's putting forth, and he's working very closely with Sergei Vita, who spearheads the growth of the Trans-Siberian Railway in the 1890s. Both of these guys are working together in tandem, hardcore, like, I mean, the whole time. So Mendeleev, he's a lover of truth, and he's looking for the confirmation that God the Creator created the universe in a way which is both discoverable to his children, human beings, but also that is made in harmony with the quality of mind of a creative person who's able to flexibly not simply be limited to deductive or inductive reasoning alone, which are two very useful techniques or mechanisms of the mind to use as tools, but either one or some combination of both will not give us a solution concept to a real discovery like what Mendeleev or Kepler or Leibniz brought to the table. It requires something additional on top of that, this creative leap, which is inexpressible in a mathematical way, but it is absolutely ontologically knowable and even necessary that it exists. But it only exists if we have certain attributes that we cultivate in terms of, you know, like humility, the ability to self-reflect and to not be arrogant, to self-reflect on what our mind is doing, our false assumptions, to let go of, you know, explanatory models we were very close to, maybe emotionally, but then to discover that there's a paradox that can't be resolved with my explanatory model, that requires a lot of courage and humility to say, I'm going to tear down my model to resolve my paradox. Sorry, yeah, go on.
Well, I was saying, like, in terms of those kind of narratives that people develop emotional investments in terms of, like, descriptions or explanations that are catch-alls for everything wrong in the world or whatever. And I mentioned, for example, well, there's anti-Semitism, there's Catholophobia, there's, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of different – where people try to essentialize a particular religion or a particular people group or a particular thing as the underlying problem. We're actually looking at things through the lens of ontology and the epistemic framework, and how there's actually been people don't really understand that this is an imperial model, from that this is a method of control that's been perfected over centuries, the British primarily, and a lot of these other matrices, a lot of these other control systems, people can go down like these false corridors or these dark alleys or whatever, and they can wind up supporting all kinds of crazy things, you know, kill them all, whatever, right? So it's those things are not accidental, because they're trying to kind of produce all these different data points and ideas, and a lot of them, just like at the beginning of the show, how you were talking about how Trudeau had actually been, the Trudeau government had been, given a lot of money to these media groups that actually paint Trudeau as a Chinese puppet, that these kinds of intelligence things it can be hard for people to understand on the face of it why they would do that. Right. But when you kind of understand the mysticism in the negative sense, or rather the obscurantism, and because there's so many potential activists, there's so many potential people that want to see change in the world, and they have a basically good idea about what's wrong and at the practical level. And then when they want to kind of get deeper, there's all of these kind of like dark roads and boogeymen, and then, you know, blame this person, blame this group, blame that, whatever. And we can actually deconstruct this to a battle of ideas. And there's not a particular person or a particular people that are at fault here. That these are battles of ideas. And then the elites, wherever they are globally, are invested in these. And as a matter of historical fact, it's been the British in our, you know, reality, in our timeline or whatever, it's been the British in this reality that have been behind so much of this.
Well said. Yeah. And I mean, it's the British is sort of like the British Empire is sort of like a useful, label to sort of get us closer to it, but it's really not that either, right? At the end of the day, because like, look, we were just talking about, you know, Steve Bannon. Well, Steve Bannon is also a character who is the frontman, who was brought into something called the Dignita Humani Institute, which is run out of this old 800-year-old monastery in Trieste in Italy, which is designed to sort of unite the different Catholic rite around something that was promoted by Otto von Habsburg, the heir to the Habsburg Empire, who ran this thing up until his death, and before that ran the Pan-Europa movement, which itself was founded by another agent of the Habsburg Empire, Richard Coudenhove Kalergi, who created this thing to bring about a sort of gateway to a one-world government and a eugenics religion, pseudo-religion for the elite to manage the diminishing human herd. But so the Habsburg Empire on one hand structurally was diminished heavily after World War I, but on another hand, the actual inner families and upper level managers of the Habsburg Empire never disappeared. They're still very active power, in the power, game itself. And, they sort of play together with their House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha counterparts. You know, these oligarchs are sort of like in it together. All of the old families, some of them go back to, like in the case of the Orsini family, right? People came to Wikipedia this. Oh, it goes back to the Roman Emperor, Julian Claudius. Right. Like, and there's several black nobility families of Italy that can directly trace their lineage back to several doges, three, popes and a couple Roman emperors. So, you're dealing with something which is, it looks like a cat, you know, it'll behave like a cat. A cat is shaped by the essence of catness. An oligarch is shaped by the essence of oligarchness, right, from the Platonic sort of language one might want to use, right? That there's this intrinsic being, that shapes the behavior kind of like a blueprint of that which is expressed in the material domain. Now, with human beings, an oligarch can change. I've seen examples of oligarchs who broke profile. You know, because we have free will, ultimately. And they're not given many chances. Culturally, they're born into very solid, rigid cultural matrices that have techniques almost to a science of grooming and corrupting the human heart and mind together in order to create somebody who will be a witting agent to advance this parasitical system into the future, right? They think transgenerationally, obviously. They think in legacy terms, which... Right. In some ways gives them more morality than your average, you know, plebe who's like walking around thinking about their day-to-day existence and not thinking about their kids' lives in a weird way.
Well, it gives them more structure. It gives them more structure and order, which are necessary for morality, but they're not more moral.
I mean, they have none of the love. Morality.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're missing love.
There should be love, agape love. There's actually hate. So right, filling right, that space, right?
Yeah. Well, and then the whole machine works differently. Well, evil is fairly well organized. It's a full-time job to be evil. It's a lot of work to be evil.
It really is, which is what gives me heart to see like the mediocrity and laziness of a lot of the current like generation of so-called grand strategists today, trying to like manage this thing they were bequeathed by their much more rigorous, you know, forefathers of evil. There's such a mediocrity and laziness that, again, it gives me hope that they're going to continuously, slip up over themselves and self cannibalize. But okay, wait, but here's the big thing. So the punchline
that
I was sort of slowly building upon.
I'm like killing this, man. So, okay.
No, but so, cybernetics. So Norbert Wiener creates in World War II, the disciple of Bertrand Russell, he fulfills the master's desires and creates now a science of controls, command and control, that he dubs then cybernetics. Cybernetics goes on to become, promoted out of world, and basically it's a science of, that he develops looking originally at the problem of feedback loops and needing to figure out where the velocity and position of missiles are going to be if you're in a war and you need to like get this information back down to the gunner, right? Ballistically. And then, then program where the missile will be in the future based on that
calculus.
Knowledge. It requires
increased
closed feedback loops that can get that information to a command center that could then do something with it.
Semiotics. Well, that's very much like computer programming or.
Yeah, and that's fine for what it is, right? It has a place. It has a place in things, but what they then try to do is coming out of World War II, you have, what's called the Macy Conferences on Cybernetics. The Macy Conferences are run by I won't say who runs it, but the Macy Foundation, the Josiah Macy Foundation was originally created to fund eugenics and the science, the pseudoscience of eugenics in the 1930s. They funded Ernst Rudin, the Nazi doctors. That was, and they worked very closely with the Rockefeller Foundation, both doing pretty much the same thing. Now, afterwards, when eugenics becomes a little bit more sticky after World War II to continue funding in the same old way, not like they stopped, but they had to sort of change their technique a lot. The Macy Foundation starts putting all of its resources into the cybernetics conferences that bring in people like Gregory Bateson, Margaret Mead, Kurt Lewin from the Frankfurt School. A lot of the leading Frankfurt School social engineers are involved in this. Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, both of whom are in charge of different departments of what becomes MK Ultra, right? And people like, for people who want to listen to Timothy Leary's, work on cybernetics or his speeches on cybernetics, they can just Google that, or Gregory Bateson's work on cybernetics. They all see that this is like the master key that will allow for the ultimate self, like the ultimate thing that Aldous Huxley calls for with the ultimate final revolution, or the guideline he puts forth in the Brave New World, is essentially there. They see it with cybernetics. That's what Russell wanted, is where you can create and basically this means a science of governance, where Norbert Wiener uses the example in his Human Use of Human Beings and Cybernetics, these two books that were both banned by Stalin, by the way. Stalin bans these books as bourgeoisie corrupting sciences that are not allowed to be published until the day Stalin dies. And then
he has a point with it.
Yeah, he does. and so what Norbert is using as a metaphor is like, he's like, look, it's like in a boat, a complex boat, you have a helmsman, and you have many people who have to do their specialized thing on the boat, but nobody except the helmsman needs to know what the boat is doing or knows how to like map out the reading of stars and astronavigation. Everybody else just needs to know their little thing. So Oompa Loompas, right? Behind the scenes.
Right.
That's all.
Compartmentalization. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all it really is. It's the way to justify radicalizing the compartmentalization of systems, which begins with NATO is immediately brought online in 1945 and very quickly is reorganized to follow cybernetic standards of controls with hyper-bureaucratized departments that are not allowed to know what their neighboring departments are fully doing. And it's only a small managerial class who are in the nerve center as helmsmen who are allowed to see what the whole system is doing. The OECD under this guy, Alexander King, who's formerly the science directorate of the British Empire, Sir Alexander King, is then brought in to overhaul the OECD under cybernetics management as well, starting in 1951. And he does it. This is the guy who later on goes on to work with Pierre-Elliott Trudeau and the whole nest of Fabians in Canada, who then create the Club of Rome, right? So he works with Aurelio Pichet in 68 to create the Club of Rome that's brought into the World Economic Forum very quickly. To justify the idea that we could treat all systems of human economies or nature as computer binary mathematical systems and thus be controlled by a small programming class in an executive grouping. So that's Alexander King. So OECD, NATO, the former Trotskyist Albert Wolfstetter, who becomes a leading controller of the RAND Corporation, brings in cybernetics as the core Bible philosophy of RAND Corps that then shapes everything from economic, military, cultural policy to Vietnam War, Korean War, everything around the idea of using computer models around probability outcomes to justify actual real world policy.
Right,
that is
which
then
is how we got to the pandemic and how we got to the whole thing with the imperial model that we had in the UK about how many people are going to die from COVID and how that justified the policies of the lockdown and et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what Khrushchev immediately brings in. He rehabilitates cybernetics. He also rehabilitates a whole bunch of Trotskyists and starts the de-Stalinization project in Russia to start basically saying that, you know, like everything that people think of as being like why Stalin is evil today, in terms of the Moscow trials that were just done to destroy his enemies, but never had any evidence that the Trotskyists ever actually had a
coherent
plan with the
Nazis. No, they had plenty of evidence. We're talking about the 1938 trials, yeah.
Yeah, you and I know that, and Grover Fur's done good work to bring a lot of this stuff that's been declassified from the KGB archives to the surface, but a lot of people who are just, you know, they're into the mainstream stuff, they read Annie Applebaum and stuff from the New York Times, and that's what they are led to believe. But I mean, the reality is that this Khrushchev secret speech that started the de-Stalinization thing and rewrote Soviet textbooks about how Stalin was actually this evil agency and started promoting, you know, all of this stuff. It was, I'm at this point convinced that Khrushchev was a closet Trotskyist. But he then goes on and rehabilitates cybernetics.
Mao makes the same accusation, Matt, by the way. Mao saw the same thing and made the same accusation. Sorry, go ahead.
Did he really? I want to see that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really want to see that. Cool. Okay, that's so interesting. So anyway, yeah, like then Khrushchev, he gives a 1960 speech to the Politburo describing how cybernetics is going to be the master key that he wants to bring into every department of the Soviet bureaucracy and to shape foreign policy, domestic policy, everything. And he gives this whole like ejaculatory speech on cybernetics, which is disgusting. I think that's part of why Brezhnev finally was able to organize something to push back against him. But it was still too rigid. Like the cybernetics cultists became increasingly influential both within the United States through these think tanks, even though Kennedy tried pushing back against them, but it also became very influential in Russia during the Cold War. And this guy, Bertrand Russell, is just everywhere, you know, like this guy is like organizing the Pugwash conference around the same period after the Soviets developed the nuclear bomb. And he's organizing in Quebec with the Soviet diplomats, also through the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, another think tank from Austria that has a huge amount of influence in Moscow during this time. He's creating a new sort of agreement around which industrial and technological progress is going to be de-emphasized in favor of a parity system of mathematical balance of terror, where every new innovation on the one side will always have to be met by some innovation on the other side of the Iron Curtain, in order to create sort of a parity of mathematical balance around which the British are able to then use the insanity, the bipolar insanity of the Cold War, to reconquer and take control using their fifth columnists of things like the United States, of Europe, and this is where you have the, you know, everything is justified. Every act of evil becomes a good in terms of the utilization of Nazi stay-behinds, Italian fascist stay-behinds under Operation Gladio. That's a part of the NATO, a secret army operation run by Nazis that occurs under the umbrella of NATO that runs terrorist cells all across the world, from like the Red Brigades.
No, I was going to say it would be Leon Trotsky in works like Results and Prospects that actually called for the United States of Europe.
Dude, Leon, I'm taking note of what you're saying right now, but between like Mao calling out Khrushchev as Trotskyist, now what you're saying about Trotsky actually calling for the United States of Europe, that falls in exactly with the Pan-Europa Kudinova-Kalergi idea, because Kudinova-Kalergi is the actual godfather of the European Union with the idea of a United States of Europe. Yeah.
Right.
That Churchill and Oswald Mosley become devotees of as well and advocates of.
Yeah, and we already established the Mosley-Trotsky connection, so yes, it's all very clear.
Fantastic stuff, man. And Trotsky openly called for that too. I'd love to get that. Please send me. I'm going to write to you to bug you to send me
that. Yeah, I have it here. Yeah, it's on my fingertips. We're right here.
Okay.
So good.
Fantastic. So that's it, man. I mean, like at the end of the day, that's their thing. Is they did this in terms of like purely at Trudeau, right? Who was a student, kind of like the way Norbert Wiener was one of Russell's boys in Cambridge. Pierre Elliott Trudeau and Kissinger were both boys of William Yandel Elliott, the Rhodes Scholar in Harvard, as was Zbigniew Brzezinski, as was Samuel P. Huntington a little bit later. And Pierre-Elliott Trudeau gives a speech in Ontario in 1969 at a Liberal convention, saying that cybernetics is the command and control, the key to solving all of the world's problems for his, what he calls his just society reforms. This is what oversees the technocratic revolution in Quebec in 1960-61. Otherwise, Quebecois are told that it was the Quiet Revolution. It was actually a technocratic overhaul of Quebec that was later replicated on the federal level in 1970-71-72. It's what oversaw the martial law, right? We had tanks running on the streets of Montreal, and we go through this in our video, the new documentary, how this cybernetics branch, this grouping, in Ottawa around Pierre-Elliott Trudeau were organizing the Special Operations Division of the RCMP that controlled, just like Gladio operations in Europe, controlled the Maoist-Leninist terrorist groups of the Red Brigades operating in Italy and France, the Years of Lead, launching terrorist, like, bombs in public squares and malls and schools, right, and killing targeted people. Same thing was happening in Quebec with the Front de Libération de Québec. Same thing was happening in the United States with the Weather Underground, nominally Maoist-Leninist, anti-imperialist, in reality, totally handled by the FBI and special intelligence agencies to justify a climate of terror to keep the population both afraid and in the embrace of their protective captured governments that would then give them
security. The kidnapping of Patty Hearst, you had the Symbionese Liberation Army, you had Vincent Amos.
Everywhere, right? And right. Jesuits play a weird role in this stuff too, but that's a side note. Now, in the case of Quebec, you know, we had martial law, the first Emergency Measures Act that was used in 1970, the killing, the murder of the deputy premier, Pierre Laporte, who was probably one of the last real Christian, you know, humanist leaders in government at the time of that happened, who was resisting some of this overhaul, the Darwinian infusions into our school system. Quebec was still, you know, it still had a Catholic sort of morality to it, like a Christian morality to it that wasn't taken over by
heavily.
So there were still, one of the biggest opposition to eugenics reforms was throughout the Cold War, the organized, Catholic movements that would deploy activists into Kentucky, into Illinois, into Alberta. It was really well organized around the idea that eugenics is Satan and we have to stop it everywhere we see it. Unfortunately, that's a far cry from the current Catholic Church under the Jesuit takeover, but still, it was
very, very, very problematic. Yeah. Well, let me say, previously we were talking about how, for example, we could look at a car accident and we could get all this data and information about it, all this linear information about velocity, rate of speed, every piece of data about every nut and bolt inside of the car and the rate of the speed, the angle of the collision, stuff like that. Right. And that's a totally different question from why did the guy run over the girl, right? Oh, they were in a bizarre love triangle and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So one is basically we live in a world of ideas and we live in a world driven by us human beings as moral, ethical beings, right? And a lot of what you get with these deterministic models, with these linear models, with these cybernetic models, you can almost use those terms interchangeably, these technocratic models, is it's trying to make something which for thousands of years have been understood as moral questions, ethical questions, and make them to be, oh no, this is a mathematical question, not an ethical question. And by doing that kind of switch from how versus why, or to do that kind of switch from, you know, what should we be doing, not what some model says is inevitably going to happen, but what ought we be doing, is meant to remove human agency, an agency that's endowed by the creator that was given to us, that we have as a faculty, nous, et cetera, and instead make these into formulas which you cannot argue that 2 + 2 = 4, and you cannot argue that you have to lock down for 2 weeks or take the jab.
Well said. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you get people like nodding their head on one point of linear truth, and then all of a sudden you impose that same logic onto something that is incommensurable. It that type of logic used for the 2 + 2 = 4 is incommensurable to why are human beings not monkeys? You know, like mathematically, one might say, well, we weigh a similar weight, you know, we have similar atomic structure, similar DNA.
98% the same genes or whatever, yeah.
All that stuff, yeah. So you're like, well, we're mathematically equivalent, identical to monkeys. But then it's like, well, but what's separating us? What is it just like that we have a slightly bigger frontal cortex? Is that the only thing that differentiates us? And if monkeys
is it just a quantitative difference?
Yeah, like is it just that or no? I mean, it's actually something that is metaphysical. It's this question of free will, of conscience, of the ability to conceptualize that which is not using an educated imagination, which can see into the past that I didn't personally experience or into the future after which I might even be dead, but I could still imagine futures that are better or worse. And then the question becomes, as far as animating my decision making, is, well, what do I want to devote my time and energy to? What do I value within the context of the small period of time I am allotted that allows me to judge what is probable or what is possible and what is necessary, right? Those are the two standards that we can really use. And there aren't really more when thinking about the future is like, well, what are possible futures and also what are necessary futures? And sometimes what is possible is not necessary. Like, you know, I can possibly shut down the carbon economy of the world. Is it necessary? Well, if I believe that human beings are just monkeys that cannot discover anything qualitatively new, but just extract limited resources in a world of diminishing returns like other animals do, then maybe I would have to say it's necessary that we reduce reduce the human population to better conform to the limits of nature that are imposed upon us. Maybe that would be the case. But if I think that, well, human beings are actually these beautiful beings made in the image of God with an immortal soul that can self-reflect and act with conscience to discover and love truth and love ourselves and love God and creation and discover creation by leaping over the limits to growth when we're creative in that specific kind of way, then more babies means more problem solvers because the world is always going to have problems.
Two heads are better than one.
Yeah. And exactly. And so every baby becomes a blessing and having more people is a good thing because you're like, okay, that's more artists, more geniuses, more ideas that can be generated willfully by these beautiful monads, made in the image of God. And so babies are no longer pollution, you know, like the materialist would have us believe. And
each human being is capable, and we're unique. Each human being is capable of providing geometrically more than they consume.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I mean, and you can't even imagine, like, cause people would say like, oh, the world pre Ben Franklin's discovery of electricity and post his discovery still used like money. There was still money in circulation. So did it just create more ability to make money happen or what? But it's like, no, the quality of the world in which the money was circulating post discovery of electricity and its application in the productive process was a qualitatively different world. But looking at the money by itself would not give you insight into the qualitative transformation that occurred in physical space-time, mental physical space-time of reality. The buying power of money was different. It could do, the role it did as far as supporting human beings was incommensurably different.
Different.
We could live longer, higher quality lives, have more of us with more access to our mental powers after the application, the occurrence number one, and then the application of those discoveries. And this is something that the Club of Rome freaks around Alexander King have always been trying to undermine and destroy from within by putting mathematical binary computing systems onto the mapping of everything in the world from both like ecologies, but also the whole universe. They've been, and Bertrand Russell had said early on and in innumerable locations, as had Norbert Wiener, that the only law of the universe that is constant is the second law of thermodynamics, entropy.
And they both speak so highly throughout so many of their writings of the belief in the immutability of entropy as something we all must assume to be absolutely true, the way that Clausius formulated this for the Royal Society back in 1865. Mm-hmm. Again, Royal Society, right? All the most garbage ideas come out of the British.
Yeah.
But what is entropy? It's just this idea that the universe is a closed system, the whole universe, right? Not that we've ever seen anything more than a tiny little sliver of a sliver of a sliver of the universe that we were created into. But now these arrogant freaks go and take some mechanical attribute of a heat engine or a fire, which has a limited amount of fuel that will always use more fuel than it creates, thus always moving towards some form of heat death. And then they extrapolate that onto the entirety of the universe in space and in time. Thus,
right, and that's where you get the second law of thermodynamics from. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. It's just the idea of death being the ultimate principle controlling the behavior teleologically of the universe towards an ultimate big blah of coldness in the future where nothing will be anymore, and before which there was nothing that came, like all things came out of this empty void of nothingness 13.7 billion years ago, as if that were even discoverable, but it's not.
Right. No, it's so ridiculous. Right. It's an entropy driven, it's an entropy death cult. Matt Arrett, Canadian Patriot Review, American Vagabond, you're working with now, putting out documentaries. Are you still doing anything with Strategic Culture Foundation? What's going
Unfortunately, on? Unfortunately, the Canadian government, whatever that is, went and sanctioned the Strategic Culture Foundation's.
So you got the nasty letter too. All right. No,
well, we
I
didn't get openly threatened the way you did, so I didn't get like a 300. If I keep writing for them, I'm going to go to jail or get a $300,000 fine or something. I didn't get that, but I was like, no, just being on the list, the sanction list itself, and I'm already on the State Department watch list. I was like, I don't need more headaches in my life, so I just was like, let's just pull back from that for a while. I love Strategic Culture, but we're not going to be
the same place. The thing about, and because we just got about 2 minutes left, and I think when people are hearing what you're talking about, and what people need to understand, okay, is that folks like Matt and other my colleagues, we are openly persecuted researchers, okay? So this is not like, oh, you know, we got three strikes on YouTube. Our governments, I wouldn't say they're after us, but they are definitely suppressing our work. They're definitely trying to put the chill on what we're doing, and they've got all their eyes and ears out, and they're not happy with you, man. So congratulations for earning their ire. We've been talking with my colleague and friend for a number of years now, Matt Arrett. Matt, it's been my pleasure to have you on. Any final thoughts as we say goodbye?
No, dude, and a big congratulations to you too. You're doing God's work, Joaquin, and no, I mean, I think, look, if people want to, actually, one thing I would say is I would like this new video that we did to go as viral as possible. So I need help. If people are able to just watch the video, watch it again, share it with friends, and really just help amplify it however you can on social media or anything else, do watch parties and discuss some of the content of, I mean, we're bringing a lot into that discussion about did China interfere in the Canadian elections? Well, why did Nazis take over control of the world after World War II, right? So have a conversation, help me spread it, and thank you, Joaquin. I always love these platforms and chatting with you,
brother. It's been my pleasure. Matt Arrett, speaking with you again. I hope to have you on again soon. Thanks so much for being with us, Matt.
Take care.
Bye. So that we've been talking to Matt, and that is our show for today, folks. XF live stream. Sometimes gets heavy, sometimes it's easy. We have tons of ideas. Yeah, this is going to go up on the drive. So there was a lot of information in there, a lot of names, dates, concepts, ideas. The cool thing is that on the drive, you can go get it. You can fish it out. Also, though, he talks and writes about this stuff all over his own materials. He's got a number of documentaries out. He's got, he writes on this regularly. I'm going to share, I guess, well, so we shared the video, we're going to share it again. There's also a couple of Telegram channels that, you can talk to people in his circle and people he works with. Also, his wife does a lot of good, material as well. She's writing a lot of good stuff, great research, many discoveries, being exposed. A lot of discoveries have been made and they're being suppressed. And that's a very important thing to understand that
Even though we can make new discoveries, there are many discoveries that are already known, and they've been known for hundreds of years, and they're being suppressed because the truth is that the direction that science was clearly going in the 14, 15, 1600s was showing that the reality of God, and of course this can be distilled through a cultural lens around the world, it's understood different ways, but the main idea that we live in a God-created realm, that this is intentional, that there are no accidents of this type on the scale, and that we are all here for a reason, has been used by the elites. They've been suppressing that so that you have this kind of ongoing state of nihilism, of despair, of you're going to get the sort of this, you know, you've heard it maybe even from RFK Jr. talking about Camus, and almost, and he's actually celebrating Sisyphean nihilism of just, you know, rolling the hill up over and over and over again. And rather than that, okay, rather than that, we aren't just finding meaning in meaninglessness, okay? We are showing that the meaning is there, it is overarching, that we are born from meaning. We're not trying to create meaning, but the primary meaning, the primary mover in this universe is what gave life to all of this. And that is the main thing that they are trying to suppress, so that you are disempowered, so that you are dependent, you are depressed, you are demoralized. And when they have you in that condition psychologically, they can suggest and enforce all kinds of things that describes much of the problem that we see in the world today. And those things that we're trying to get out there are probably chiefly the reason that we're being so heavily targeted and censored and repressed by the governments, from whom we still have our passports, I'm going to say. But no, I am an American. I'm proud enough of that fact. I'm not very proud of a lot of things that have been done in my country's name. And I don't live in the United States. But I will say that I still have hope. And I have, I think, reasonable hope. I'm seeing people wake up every day. I'm seeing change happening at the local level. And it's small. And then all of a sudden. So I want you guys never to forget that. It's been my pleasure to be with you today, XF Livestream. We'll be with you again Monday, 1 o'clock, Rome, Belgrade time, same bat time, same bat channel. Peace. I'm out.